This is Kelly Craker conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Don Aird. Today is 15 April 2014. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Aird is kind enough to join me by telephone from his home in Fenton, Missouri. Mr. Aird, to begin the interview, I'd like to get some biographical information from you, if I could. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in Bottineau. It's spelled B-O-T-T-I-N-E-A-U, North Dakota, November 14th, 1943.
Okay, now, what were your parents' names?
My mother's name was Clarissa, C-L-A-R-I-S-S-A, Clarissa. Dad's name, the same as mine, Don Sr., Donald William.
Oh, okay. Now, did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one sister. Her name is Christine.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living up there?
My mother worked at a drug store in a neighboring town. And my father was in, actually he was in England when I was born. He was with the United States Army. He was a firefighter.
Oh, is that right? Did he see service in World War II?
Yep. Yeah, he helped fight the fires from the V1s and V2s.
No kidding.
And then they sent him to Europe, and he was in Belgium and France. He wasn't in any kind of combat, but he was there.
Hmm. Do you know what unit he served in?
You know, I don't. Sorry to say, he served in several. Mm-hmm. He actually did an oral interview for BBC Radio, and I had a copy of that. And I turned it over to the North Dakota Historical Society. But I'd heard it before. At the end, he says he can't wait to get home to see his newborn son, Donald.
Oh, wow. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. Did you grow up in the Dakota?
Yes, sir. I grew up in a town called Wahpeton, W-A-H-P-E-T-O-N, North Dakota.
What was it like for you growing up there? I mean, you're looking at the 1940s into the 1950s, growing up in that part of the world. What was life like for you growing up?
Well, first of all, the wind never stops blowing. So everything you do, you deal with the wind. And we, of course, get a lot of snow and ice. And went through my first blizzard when I was in first grade. I had to stay home from school. But basically, we were outside all the time. We were never inside. We were always doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Every male member of my class had a rifle and a shotgun. We would go out hunting pheasants and ducks and geese and deer. Mm-hmm. It was really enjoyed. I would not have left North Dakota if I could have found work.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, what about school? How did you do in school?
I was a marginal student. I was put in the dumb class. I was not motivated at all in school. Mm-hmm. I got C's, I guess you could say, through high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on to college, and I did a little better there. I got C's and B's, and then I went on and got my graduate degree in microbiology.
Hmm. So it sounds like you made a turn there somewhere along the line.
Yeah, after Vietnam.
Yeah. Now, growing up in the 40s and the 50s, of course, the overweening international development, as we saw, was the Cold War. What do you remember about the Cold War growing up?
I just remember starting with Korea. I was, I guess, maybe 8 years old when that was going on. And then we had all these drills, duck and cover for nuclear events. We're told to take iodine pills. The Soviet Union was huge in our lives. They had the Sputnik come out, and I was in the 8th grade biology class, and they said, no, we've got to do something about our science. We're falling behind, and that's all you ever heard.
Yeah. Now, is that something that you took to heart to become more of a focus for you personally in the math and science and things like that?
Yeah, I had a real interest in science. I wasn't very good at math, but I loved science.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a lot of science courses over the years. I still take them when I can.
Oh, very cool, very cool. As you're going through high school, was there anything that you wanted to do when you graduated? Did you have a career path in mind? Was college in your future as you saw it then? What did you plan on doing?
Yeah, my dad was big on this. His father made sure that his kids got college. This is back when that was really rare.
Mm-hmm.
And he insisted that my sister and I get a college degree. I had no idea what I was going to do with it, but I knew I was going to college.
Mm-hmm. And was this something that you tried to pursue immediately out of high school?
Yeah, right away. Back then, we all registered for the draft. I don't remember if I was 16 or 17.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't go to college, you were going to get drafted. So right away, I got into a college.
And what college did you go to?
It's a little two-year school in Wahpeton. It's called State. Then it was called State School of Science. I'm not sure what they call it now. But it's a two-year college, mostly auto mechanics and auto body, things like that. And then they had a small junior college hooked in with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you going to pursue more of a hands-on kind of career, or were you considering going to the full four-year college? What did you want to do?
Yeah, I knew I was going to try and get a four-year degree, but I still didn't have any idea what it was going to be. Although, again, I was leaning towards the sciences.
Mm-hmm. When did you enter this this school?
I started September 1961.
September of 61, okay.
Yeah, and I just went 1 year there, and I went 4 years out of Western North Dakota, a school called Dickinson State.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had been transferred. He was a soil conservation engineer, and they moved him out to Dickinson, so I went with him and stayed at home, went to school there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned that you go to school in college, that is, in 61. Of course, this is the era of Kennedy, as it were. What were your thoughts on on President Kennedy?
Well, we were Republicans, so we weren't real fond of him. But, then the assassination, I just happened to be in class when that happened in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
I was in organic chemistry class, ran over noon, I came upstairs. I always went to the library. I like to read in the library. And when I walked in the door, the librarian said, the president is dead. And, wow. And she was a nut on, nobody saying it or doing anything in that library. So right away I knew what happened.
Well, speaking of Kennedy here, what do you remember about his presidency in terms of foreign issues, the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs, and all of these things happened kind of in rapid-fire order there. What sort of things do you remember about those events?
I remember the Bay of Pigs. My dad and my uncle, everyone was wondering what in the hell we were doing in Cuba. We thought it was, of course, it wasn't necessarily Kennedy's fault. It was something he inherited. The Cuban Missile Crisis, that was a huge one. My dad was really concerned that we were going to be in World War III.
Mm-hmm.
It sure looked like it was going that way.
Yeah.
The ongoing thing in the Berlin Wall, everyone was really concerned that communism was going to spread to Europe and maybe even to Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
That was our overriding concern.
Yeah. And, I think that a lot of people, when all these years gone past, have forgotten what that environment was like. It was a very real, palpable threat between the Soviet Union and the United States. And obviously that colors the way people viewed what was going on internationally and obviously is the backdrop for all of the foreign policy decisions that both countries were making at the time. So you go to college in 1961, but I believe you mentioned that you had finished after you got back from Vietnam. Is that correct?
Well, I actually got my degree before I went over there.
Okay.
I got my bachelor's degree in 1966, and I got a teaching deferment.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't want to go in the military, so the only way to get out of it was to teach, and I actually was teaching in the county where my draft board was, Richland County. And I really felt safe that, I could, all I had to do is stay out of the draft until I was 26, and I wouldn't be eligible anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was it about the military that didn't appeal to you? Why did you want to avoid the service, as it were, or at least the draft?
I don't do real well with authority. I've never done in high school or anywhere else. I don't like to have people telling me what to do all the time, and it really had no appeal to me.
Mm-hmm. So you you have a brief career, I guess, teaching. What were
I
you teaching?
3 years.
Yeah, so you taught for 3 years, and teaching at the same place, I guess, for 3 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And teaching what, science, I guess.
Yeah, it's a small school, so I taught, it was biology, chemistry, earth science, physical science, and eighth grade math.
Mm-hmm.
So I had multiple preparations, but I taught everything but physics in that school.
Hmm. They were certainly getting their money's worth out of you, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Now, you will eventually enter the military. What were the circumstances for that?
Well, North Dakota, you know, everybody had a draft quota, and I actually knew the draft board chair, whatever he was. He went to church with me. I grew up with his kids. His name was Wally Norgard. And Wally said, look, Aaron, he says, I don't want to draft you. He said, but we ran out of bodies. So I understood that. So
yeah.
I went.
Yeah. When did you get your draft notice?
I got it in May, but they let me, I worked at a boys camp in the summer, so they let me finish there. So they moved it up to August of 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Actually have my draft notice here.
Oh, wow. So you were teaching
at this time. Yeah.
And the Vietnam War obviously has been going on to varying degrees during this time once you finished college. What did you know about what was going on in Southeast Asia?
What you saw every night, and this is everybody, was the body counts. How many people died that day?
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I remember. I just, you know, kind of 109, 89, you know, thinking, oh, my God, you know, this is no place for Mrs. Aird's favorite son.
Right. Did you keep up with it on a pretty regular basis? I mean, how the war was being prosecuted and the political aspects of it. And, of course, by 1969, when you enter the Army, you know, war protests are taking place. What did you know about what was going on domestically as it related to the Vietnam War?
Well, I've read extensively all my life, Time, Newsweek, newspapers. So I kept up pretty well on that, the Chicago 68 Democratic Convention,
mm-hmm.
and all the other things that were going on. And it was, you know, it was very confusing,
yeah.
Trying to figure out what was really happening here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you knew the chair of the draft board, and like you said, he didn't want to draft you, but he did.
Yeah, he had to do it.
So you had a little bit of trepidation, I would assume, about entering the draft, entering the Army, because Vietnam very likely would have been in your future, I would guess.
Right, and I was 26, and I was in the best of shape.
Mm-hmm.
And when I reported for induction, there was one other guy with me, and the lady there said, one of you is going to be a Marine, and I almost had a heart attack. And this other guy said, I always wanted to be a Marine, so I said, bless you, you know, thank God for that. That was the worst, that was the lowest point in my life, was that when she said, one of you is going to be a Marine.
But obviously it wasn't going to be you in this case.
Oh, it could have been.
Right, right. So
not that I have anything against Marines, but I didn't think I was Marine material.
Sure, it's a whole different lifestyle, as it were, to be in with Marines. So when do you report for basic training, and where do you go?
I'm trying to remember, sometime in August, like the 16th, they put us on a train in Fargo. There was 50 of us, and they shipped us out to Fort Lewis, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
When we got there, they didn't know we were coming.
Hmm.
So we're a bunch of civilians right in the middle of this Fort Lewis, Washington. They wouldn't feed us at the mess hall, but we could get pizza and donuts. So that's for the weekend. We got in Saturday until Monday. We had no bedding. We had beds with mattresses, but no bedding. No towels, no soap. And all we had to eat, which was all right, was pizza and donuts, but we made it work.
Right, yeah. It might be a different thing today if a dietitian were to look at what sort of food you need to be ready for boot camp. Pizza and donuts probably wouldn't have been on that list, I would guess.
No.
Well, take me through your boot camp experience. What was that like for you?
Well, they've got your records there, and the drill sergeant found out I was a high school teacher. In fact, I had one of my students in my platoon.
Hmm.
He's the kid I had for biology class. I was in real bad shape. I mean, I needed to get out and start running. I was doing that, and I fell, and I punched a hole in my knee. I actually went through my kneecap.
Hmm.
So they bandaged it up, and for about the next 4 weeks, I really couldn't run or do anything, so I'd fallen behind physically from all the rest. In fact, they were talking about recycling, which is the wrong thing you don't want to do. You don't want to have go back to start some of this stuff again.
Right.
So I worked really hard at it, and I didn't set any records, but I got 360 out of 500 points when I took my physical test. So I did pass, but didn't light them up.
Right.
It was fire watch. It was an hour on. Maybe every other night, they wake you up. You'd walk around the barracks we were in were World War II barracks, and they told us it would burn in less than 5 minutes if a fire started. So we had to have people up walking around.
Mm-hmm.
We got up every day at 5:30. I got up earlier because of my knee, so I was trying to get ready before anybody else started, and I managed to stay with it.
Yeah. What was your daily routine like there? A lot of physical activity, obviously.
Yeah, it was kind of neat. We were in Fort Lewis, Washington. When we lined up for formation every morning, we were looking right at Mount Rainier, and the snow was starting to come down. This was now September going towards October, and it looked like marshmallow topping, but you realize when it got some point, we're going to be seeing a lot of rain, which they're known for.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a little concerned that we're going to be caught up in that. But you go, we had rifle training, we had physical, doing all the calisthenics. We had some book training. A couple of things really stood out. We had a training for gas mask training, dealing with all that. They used tear gas, and what you don't know is that tear gas, obviously, it's hard to breathe, but if you get wet in, like, your armpits and your crotch, and you expose to tear gas, it burns like hell.
Hmm.
It is really uncomfortable. So what our drill sergeant did, he had us low crawl through a ditch with water in it before we ever started our training. So the whole thing was, to say that we were all really unhappy would have been a understatement.
Mm-hmm.
We would have killed somebody if we could have. It was just really, really nasty.
Yeah. Yeah, I would bet. So you make it through basic training. Like you said, you didn't necessarily light it up, I believe were the words that you used, but you make it through, with the problem with the knee and all of that. So you make it through your basic training. The next step, of course, I assume, is AIT. Where did that take place?
They put us on a plane in Seattle and flew us to Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Okay.
That was my first plane ride my whole life.
Now, did you put in for artillery?
No, I didn't. I was trying to stay in the United States. I put in for chemical warfare and a couple other things.
Mm-hmm.
Artillery wasn't on the list.
But it was on their list, and there you go.
They said because I taught eighth grade math that I was a good candidate for that.
Okay, well, then that stands to reason, of course. So take me through your time there at Fort Sill. What was AIT like there in artillery?
Okay, it was a whole lot different. We had to go through all the cleaning up the barracks and do all the inspections and all that stuff. And back in basic training, I had to go to KP. And the mess sergeant liked me, so he made me the dining room orderly. So all I had to do is run around, make sure they had salt and pepper shakers, and set out the stuff. So I got to Fort Sill because my name is Aired. I was first on the list. We got in late. They had me hang up a uniform for the next day's inspection. What I didn't know is that all those uniforms were starched. They had a place there at Fort Sill to get that done. But we got in so late, we didn't get a chance to do this. this wrinkled uniform hanging there, and everybody else got starched uniforms. Well, the drill sergeant saw that, and he hid my uniform, but from then on they called me Wrinkle. Okay. So the first week I had KP. So we're going, what we're learning to do is to tell the artillery pieces where to fire, what to fire, deflection, deflection quadrant, that's up and down, this quadrant deflection is left and right. We had to plot the targets, do all this stuff. There's a lot of stuff you have to learn, but it's all book learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to catch up. Like, I always started off, I don't know why, but it's like I'm always starting in a hole. And KP put me in a hole because we missed hours of training doing KP.
Mm-hmm. So I would assume, I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead, please.
But I was going to say I caught up. It wasn't anything difficult. It's in fact, it was really interesting learning how to do all this stuff.
It would have been quite a bit of classroom, I guess, then. A lot of math.
Yeah, it was all class. Oh, you got a lot to learn there.
Yeah.
You got to learn how to make your charts. You had to learn how to work with something called sight. So if your target is above you, you got to add something. If it's below, you got to add something. You had to work in your wind speed, wind velocity. It's quite interesting training, actually.
Mm-hmm. And you did pretty well at this, I assume?
Yeah, I ended up in the 90th percentile. It was probably a miracle, but I did it anyway. So I did all right there. I trying to think if there's anything special about Fort Sill. Oh, the skunks. We were in basic training. We were not allowed off our barracks area. You couldn't go anywhere. You had to stay right there. The only time you got away from there was to get a haircut. Once a week, they'd take you and get a haircut, and then you could buy some candy or some gum or something. Once you got to Fort Sill, the first week, we were the lowest of the four training companies as far as scores go, so we had to stay in our company area. But after that, we managed to keep somebody below us all the time, so we got all the freedom. We could go into town, you go anywhere in the post. So they had about 10 theaters on post, and I go to a different movie every night. In the weekends, when we weren't doing anything, I'd go into Lawton, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and get something to eat and go see a movie there.
Yeah. How long did AIT last?
It was the same 8 weeks.
8 weeks. Okay.
Or eight. I think that's right.
That
it was the same
right.
as basic. So yeah. I think it was 8 weeks.
Now, at AIT, do you have instructors there that had been to Vietnam?
Yeah, in fact, we just had one instructor. We were his last class. He was retiring. He had 20 years in, and he was he worked really hard with us. You know, you're tired. Okay, you get up at 5:30 in the morning. Sometimes people fell asleep, and his platform was even with their tables. You'd see someone asleep, and he'd walk across their table and smack them with a rolled up paper, wake them up. I can't remember his name. He was really good.
Yeah. Was he able to offer any sort of special insight about what he saw in Vietnam and how to apply what you were learning there at Fort Sill?
No, actually, there was nothing that he even talked about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He was just talking about what we were going to do when we got there, which is surprising. You know, when you think about it, he had been there. It would have been helpful if you had told us some of the things we were going to run into,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't happen.
Yeah. Of course, there's classroom learning, and then there's practice and all of that, but then there's real life, what's going on in Vietnam, and, you know, the conditions in Fort Sill would have been drastically different from those you saw in Vietnam, you know, in terms of climate and elevation and those kinds of things. So I would assume that would have kind of played into it as well.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So as you are working your way through AIT, do you think there's any chance that you're going to remain stateside, or do you know that Vietnam is in your future?
Well, that's really interesting. That's one of my favorite stories. We had there was a class every 2 weeks. So when the next class to us graduated, we all were hiding around the corner to see where they went. Half went to Germany and half went to Vietnam. So we got up there for we graduated, and the drill sergeant stand there, and he said, "I suppose you want to know where you're going?" And so we said, "Yeah." He said, "You're all going to Vietnam." So we laughed. He walked away. Every one of us got orders for Vietnam.
No kidding.
Yeah, the other class, half of them didn't go. It's really, really discouraging.
I would guess so. You know, this war is going to be in your future now.
Yeah.
Are you following it any more closely than you had been before? Talking to people, reading newspapers, following it on television, anything like that?
Actually, we didn't have any of that.
Hmm.
So until I got home, you know, since August, I really hadn't seen anything in the news,
mm-hmm.
or heard anything. So I got home. Really, I was, I don't know. I'm home in North Dakota. It's just before Christmas. I didn't even want to think about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to be with family and friends, and that's all I did.
You know, I've heard other individuals tell me that the leave after AIT before shipping out to Vietnam sometimes could have been difficult for someone, knowing that you're kind of in a limbo here. You're going off to war. You don't necessarily want to make any long-range plans for anything. That you know, and sometimes these guys would have a little bit more difficulty relating to the guys they grew up with their family and friends, you know, that aren't in the military, who aren't going off to war. Did you find that to be the case?
No, actually, we... excuse me. It didn't happen like that at all. We had... I'd see family and friends. I used to drink beer quite a bit, and we'd go out and have a beer, and we didn't even talk about Vietnam. We just had a good time. I really wasn't going to look ahead to see what was coming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that makes sense, Stan. It's a reason for sure. What about your family? What did they think about your receiving orders for Vietnam?
Well, Dad wasn't excited, but he had been there. Mm-hmm. He didn't like the war, so this became a problem when I came home, but not going over there.
Yeah.
My uncle didn't like the war. It became a problem after I came home, but again, not before that. Everybody was pretty supportive, and my birth mother died when I was 8. My dad remarried, and my stepmother was... she would come to send me a care package of food every month until I got home. So we, you know, I had that kind of support. Mm-hmm. My sister wanted my car, but I sold it. so that's where that went.
Yeah, thanks, Don. I appreciate that. you mentioned that your father and your uncle were opposed to the war. What was the grounds for their opposition?
Well, they were both big Eisenhower fans. Now, my uncle was a Democrat, my dad was a Republican, but Eisenhower said, you know, we shouldn't be getting involved in these wars in Southeast Asia. He's trying to tell Kennedy that. And they both agreed. They said, we have no business being there. Nothing's going to come out of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that it would be difficult for a father whose son is going over to a war that the father does not believe is something that we should be involved in. I think as a parent myself, I would think that would be a very, very difficult thing for a family to have to go through.
Yeah, Dad was really stoic, if you would. Mm-hmm. He never in my life did he ever say he loved me.
Hmm.
But, you know, he did, okay? He
sure.
did everything for me. He made sure I got my education, yada, yada, yada. But he wouldn't give anything away. He was a lot like American Indians that way. He never really knew what was going on in his mind.
Yeah. Okay, so the day is eventually coming for you. Here we are, the winter of 1969 into 1970. When do you prepare to go out to leave for Vietnam? Do you leave from Fort Lewis, I assume?
No, actually, I left from Oakland.
Okay, okay.
They sent me out to Oakland. It was Super Bowl Sunday, and the Vikings were playing Kansas City.
Oh, wow.
It's 24 hours of process through, so when I get done, I'm getting on the plane. It's halftime of the game. And, of course, we're big Viking fans. We're Minnesota
sure.
Viking fans. And it took me almost 3 weeks to find out who won that damn game.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And then it didn't turn out all that well for the Vikings fans, of course.
No, it did not. But, you know, it's pretty funny. I met Bud Grant not that many years ago. He was signing autographs.
Oh, really?
Coach. Yeah, he's quite a guy. Anyway... I said, Coach, I said, you know, I missed the second half of your game. You'd have to know Bud Grant. He said, he didn't miss anything. So I get to Vietnam, and we had no idea what happened with the game, but then you're not thinking anymore about the game.
Right, sure, sure. Well, that takes us to a good point here. You're leaving from here from the West Coast. What is that trip like for you from the U.S. over to Vietnam?
About a third of us were guys that put a year in and were going to put 6 more months in, so they had been there.
Mm-hmm.
The guy sitting next to me had been there before, so I didn't ask him anything, but I was watching him. We flew at a commercial airline. I can't remember who it was. We had really attractive stewardesses to Hawaii. We get to Hawaii. They changed crews. We had 20 minutes in the airports at midnight. I was going to have a drink, I remember, so I went down the bartender saw us coming. He tried to close the door. He was ready to close up. We forced our way in. So I had my drink, and I found some fresh pineapple. I never had fresh pineapple before. So we get back on the plane. The next stop is Midway. They changed stewardesses again. Well, after, between Hawaii and Midway, the stewardesses got decidedly uglier, and they were just really, they were not putting up with any crap from us. Well, the next change was even worse. I mean, these people were, no one talked to, no one bothered the stewardess anymore. But still the same commercial plane, but we got there. We were flying down the coast of Vietnam. I looked out the window, and this is close to Tet. I know Tet is, in my mind, I know Tet is coming up. And there's a lot of black smoke coming up. I mean, maybe 1,000 columns of black smoke. Hmm. And I said, oh, my God, I said, they're fighting. And the guy next to me, he'd been there before. He looked out the window. He said, no, that's not what they're doing. He said, they're burning shit. That's the first I heard about that. So 8 o'clock in the morning, everybody's burning shit all over Vietnam, and there's a lot of black smoke.
Yeah, you mentioned Tet. The year before that, I guess it would have been 2 years before that.
2 years, yeah.
With the big Tet Offensive of 1968. Let me take you back here just a little bit. What did the, what kind of effect did that have on you, if any, knowing what went on in January, February of 1968?
Oh, again, I put the fear of God in me. That,
yeah.
Everybody's fighting everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the media really portrayed it different than what was really going on.
Mm-hmm.
They made it look like the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were had the upper hand when, in fact, that was not the case. But you really thought you were getting into something here.
Yeah. And there, you know, 2 years later, roughly, you're coming in country. I can understand your a little bit of anxiety on your part, if that's what it was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Especially when you see that black smoke.
Right.
I was really concerned. But once you understand what's going on, it's a lot easier.
Yeah. Where did you come in country?
Came in Tonsonut.
Mm-hmm.
And when they open the door, the first thing hits you is the smell. It smells like rotten garbage. And then the heat and humidity rolls in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in North Dakota, it was 10 below zero. I get to Vietnam, it's 80 or maybe 90 degrees. And it was always difficult for me with the heat and humidity. But that first shot, that was really a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm.
The sergeant that meets us at the plane, he says, you see those guys, there's a group of men standing over there, and he said, you guys are their best friends. And he said, you know why? And I said, no one knew why. He said, because you're bringing them their freedom bird.
Hmm.
So they're going home, and you know you got a year to do. You really start sinking lower and lower.
Hmm.
Well, they put us on buses, and they took us to this replacement center. I've forgotten the name of it. But on the way to the replacement center, you're going by LBJ, and it's maybe 2 miles of barbed wire, razor wire. LBJ was long been jail.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did that deliberately so you could see what would happen to you if you screwed up over there, because there's thousands and thousands of guys in there.
Yeah. Yeah, this would have been, I think, a very real eye-opener for a guy who just shows up in Vietnam. The heat, the humidity, the smoke, the uncertainty, and on top of all that, by the way, you screw up, here's where you're going to wind up.
Exactly.
So it could very well have been a lesson for you there. So you show up at, I guess, what, probably Benoit, the 90th replacement depot?
Yeah, I think it was
like
the 90th, yeah.
Yeah. So what is it like there at Benoit? You show up, you're new in country, you're a little older than the rest of the guys, but still, this is very, very new for you. What's it like to be in this war zone in the midst of all of these people and all of this activity? You wind up in Benoit. What are you seeing? What are you experiencing there?
Oh, it's chaos. It's unbelievable. There's people going everywhere. They have formations read out your orders, where you're going. So the very first formation I get in, the heat and humidity is, you know, it's overpowering, and you're really close to other people there. And then it started raining. And I thought in my mind, you know, this is going to cool us down. But in fact, it turned it into a sauna, and there were actually people dropping, passing out all around me. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to make through a year of this stuff? So they read the orders for some people, and then they picked people up for work details, shit burning, KP. So what you're doing there is you're trying to duck all the work details but still hear your orders when they're called.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of find a corner, you find a place to hide. Food, they had It wasn't great food, but there was a lot of food was always available. I don't remember going into any barracks sleeping anywhere. I don't remember that at all. But when my orders were called, I went out and I got them, and they told me you got to go back to the Donsnoot, catch a plane to your unit, which was the 24th Corps. So when I got to Donsnoot, nobody knew where the 24th Corps was. So they just put me on the first available plane, and I actually went to, made four stops before I got up to Phu Bai, where the 24th Corps was.
So you get your orders, you know what unit you're going to be assigned to at this point. What unit was it going to be again?
It's called 24th Corps.
Mm-hmm.
It's Corps Artillery for what they didn't know was I Corps. They had all the units that were not organic to, like the 101st of the AmeriCal, were all bundled under the 24th Corps.
Mm-hmm. And they tell you what you're going to be doing there. You know you've been trained, you're going to be working with field artillery once you get up there.
Right.
What is it like for you as a new guy here, the FNG, as it were, to show up to this new unit? How are you received? What's the environment like? What's the pace of activity like there? Tell me what you see when you first arrive.
Okay, you first come up there at Phu Bai. Outside of Phu Bai is something called Camp Eagle. It's this huge military base. The Marines started, and then the 101st inherited it. So they sent me up to what was the 1st of the 83rd. That was my organic unit. The 1st of the 83rd is three batteries, mixed batteries of 8-inch 175s. The battalion is at Camp Eagle. In the corner of Camp Eagle, there's a huge Vietnamese cemetery, the largest in Vietnam, across the wire. And on the right side is a medevac unit, and that's another set of wire there. So we're in kind of a corner bordered by medevac and then a cemetery, and there's a Marine bridge building unit across the road. So when you get up there, they give you a little orientation, and they talk a little bit about the 1st, the 83rd. And during the orientation, they mentioned that we had one battery that invaded North Vietnam. And that's all he said. So I'm really curious about this, but I didn't learn about this circumstance until many years later. They send you out to GLA, you go into battalion, you're a fire direction, so they put you in the battalion fire direction center, and they teach you what you're going to do when you get out to the battery.
And what are they telling you you're going to be doing? What are your responsibilities?
Okay, when a fire mission comes in, you got the guy on the radio, he takes down the firing data. You have to have three sets of clearance before anything else happens. You have to have air clearance, ground clearance, and medevac clearance. You get three sets of initials. They go on the top right-hand corner of the sheet you're working on. Then you get your coordinates. Either, most of the time we got our coordinates straight from battalion. They would give us all the coordinates. They tell us what kind of shell we're going to shoot, and tell us when we're going to shoot. Then somebody takes that. When you get the first coordinate, somebody's at a vertical map. You're going to plot that first target so you can figure out what the elevation is. That's for sight. Mm-hmm. Somebody else plots the target on a horizontal circular chart so you can tell the gun which direction to point in. So all this happens at the same time. We had a fire direction computer called Freddy, FADAC. Somebody would go outside and start the generator for Freddy. Freddy ran on a 3K generator. And somebody would sit down to Freddy. So you got a guy plotting the target for elevation, you got a target being plotted for direction, and then Freddy's being fired up. We're going to do most of our calculation on Freddy. So we put the data in Freddy. He spits out quadrant and elevation for the gun. We already know what the fuse is. 8-inch 175s are very straightforward. There's only one shell, that's HE. There's three fuses, variable time, and point detonating.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to have delayed fuse delay, but we never got any of those. So up for 8-inch 175, it's a really simple operation, nothing like you'd have to go through with a 105 or a 155. And it took the gun maybe up to 10 minutes to get turned and pointed in the right direction. So you're learning all this back at battalion, what you're going to do.
Now, these were self-propelled, were they not?
Yeah, they're, I forgot what they call, M110s. They're, mm-hmm. They weigh 29 tons. They're a General Motors V8 diesel. It's the same engine and transmission that they used in Greyhound buses back then.
So now this is what you'd been trained on back at Fort Sill as well?
No, actually we're trained on 105.
Okay, you had 105s there. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Everybody was trained on a 105. So you're dealing with a whole different, but it's easier with the 8-inch 175 than it is with a 105 or 155. You don't have all the variables that you had.
Hey, explain that to me. For someone who's not initiated with this, what kind of differences would there be in this type of plotting and fire direction?
Okay, first of all, the shells that you shoot, we didn't have any smoke, we didn't have any Willy Peter, white phosphorus, so we didn't have to deal with any of that stuff. There's a mission called high angle, and it's real easy to explain. If you're trying to hit a target on the other side of a hill, you can't shoot straight at it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you remember your garden hose, you're shooting the water out there, if you lift the hose up, the water comes back towards you, but at a higher angle.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do with a high-angle mission with a 105 or 155 is you'd raise the tube quite a bit higher until you had roughly the right angle to get the other side of the hill. We didn't have to do any of that stuff. We were very straightforward, just point and shoot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now you're getting all of this information here at Jalay. How long does it take before you're comfortable with what you're doing and what you're going to be doing in these fire support missions?
Okay, first of all, they kept some of those guys back, and I'm really hoping they're going to let me stay back at GLA because they got a great setup. This huge base, you got a great PX, you got a really nice club. So you're trying to impress them, but I guess I didn't because they sent me out. After 2 weeks, they said, you're ready to go, and the way I went to Charlie Battery, which was at that time, they just moved to Sally, Fire Support Base Sally.
Mm-hmm.
So Fubai is south of Way. Sally is the first base north of Way.
So you're moving up a little bit further away from the,
yeah.
I guess, creature comforts, as it were.
Yeah, there's no creature comforts.
Yeah, right.
At Sally.
Yeah. Okay, now take me through this next step in the process here. You move out to this new unit. Your boots on the ground here, you're with Charlie Battery. Charlie Battery's been there. You're a replacement. You've got these other guys who have been there for a while. What was the dynamic like within the battery itself between the people, the leadership, the attitude, the morale? Tell me about Charlie Battery when you arrived.
Yeah, I get into Charlie Battery. They just moved from, I think it was Roy. They put in a hellacious monsoon. These guys were really on edge. They'd moved up to a fire support base, Bastogne, in September 1969. The first day there, it rained 25 inches in 24 hours.
Wow.
By the end of September, they had 129 inches of rain. They're moving. Okay, so let's look at the shells real quick.
Sure.
8-inch had a 200-pound shell. 175 had a 147-pound shell. To carry them, they put them on what they call the sled, so it just sits on there. Two men carry that shell up to the gun. The gun's got a device that loads it automatically. But to get from the shed to the gun, they got to go through mud that's up to their waist.
Hmm.
And once in a while, the round would slip off the sled. And it took those guys an hour, 10 men an hour, to get that thing back out. It's round. You got nothing to hold on to. The mud is sucking it down. I mean, this is miserable, miserable condition. Everybody's ready to go home right now.
Yeah.
So they're not a bunch of happy campers. So I get in. I get a little talk from the battery commander. His name is Captain Hall. And I go in the fire direction, and they assign me to, there's two shifts. So we run fire direction 24 hours a day. So one shift starts at 4:30 in the morning, goes to 4:30 in the afternoon. The second one comes on at 4:30 in the afternoon, goes to 4:30 in the morning. they set the schedule so that when it gets really hot, there'd be a period of time where everybody gets a little cool as you're going to get, time to sleep. So they just assigned me, it's easy enough to put me on reading elevations or charting the direction of the gun. None of this is very difficult, so I got work in all of that and also get on the radios.
So would it be fair to say that the guys that you run into there at Charlie Battery, you mentioned, you know, the sucking mud and all these difficult conditions, was their morale good? Was it poor? How would you describe that?
The morale was not bad, but we had a problem with marijuana smokers. Maybe 20 to 25% of the battery was smoking marijuana. They come out of Bastogne, they got to Sally. There was a little village very close there, and a lot of opportunity to buy marijuana. In fact, just to back up a little bit, when I came in country, the very first day in country, there was a Vietnamese outside the wire by the cemetery, and he motioned for me to come over there. So I walked over, and, you know, I don't know anything. I've got my uniform isn't even muddy yet. Mm-hmm. And he's got this, looked like a brick, brown brick in a plastic bag, and he's saying $2, $2. So I try to figure out what's going on, so I get up a little closer, and then I can see those are plants. You can see the leaves, and this was a brick of marijuana. I can't imagine how big it was, and for $2 I probably could have had enough to keep me going for a whole year there.
Wow.
And I remember I panicked right away. I thought, oh my god, this is the last thing I need to do is get caught with that.
Right.
So I literally ran away from that guy. So now, again, in the battery, there's these guys. You can smell it. It's a very distinct smell. They would smoke in the latrines a lot of the time, because then somebody came near them, they'd throw the joint down into the crapper, and, you know, no one's going after that.
Right.
So any time you went to use the bathroom, you'd smell it.
Did marijuana use cause any problems, any friction within the unit?
Well, surprisingly, it didn't. The guys smoking marijuana didn't help with the fire mission, but they had enough guys to run the mission without them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why they put up with it. I wouldn't have, but I wasn't on the gun. It's not really, shouldn't have been any of my concern, but I thought, these guys are just skating on you guys, and you're letting them.
Huh. Did anyone else voice these similar concerns?
Of course, the management, if you would, First Sergeant, Battery Commander, and the section chiefs were not happy with any of this. The guy that ran the firing battery is called a chief of smoke, and we had a really good one. He's a black guy from Houston. I'm trying to remember his name. Harris was his name. Really smart, really motivated. One day, I was around the corner, and I heard him talking to some of the black men on the guns there, and he was giving them, he was really upset with him, because he said, look, Army is a great place for you. You get all kinds of, you know, they take care of you. You make a decent living. He said, after 20 years, you can retire and go do something else. He said, you guys need to quit doing all this other stuff that the black people were doing then, you know, the dapping and all the other stuff. Back then, there was a real problem with race relations. You know, the blacks all hung together. Then we had the redneck white guys. And then, of course, fire direction, we didn't have any of that stuff. But on the guns, when they're kind of in the rear area, they would all just kind of gather together. And this Sergeant Harris really didn't understand the way this was going. And again, like you said, he was a really great guy. I really liked him. But he could see the handwriting on the wall there. This is not the same Army he grew up in.
Yeah. Now, did the racial tensions boil over? Were there any major issues that came out of this?
Not with our unit. Just to jump way ahead, when we got out to Bagel, something happened with the cooks. All our cooks were black but one. And they used to have a meeting every afternoon that where the section chiefs, chief smoke, and the battery commander and the firing officers would get together and have this half-hour meeting. These cooks got into the meeting, and they had M16s, and they had already charged them. And I never heard or no one ever explained to me what happened. But the tension was diffused, and then that was the end of it. We never had another problem.
I'll be darned. Interesting.
But, you know, it's really strange. I mean, God, am I... I wasn't in leadership, thank God, but the chief smoked and came and told me about it.
Huh. And no idea what was, you know, the spark that started this.
Just no, not at all. Just really strange.
Yeah, that's really odd. So it sounds like, it's not unusual, I don't think, to show up in, you know, in early 1970, when there are some morale problems and discipline problems, there are racial issues, there's drug use causing some issues as well. So your experience there certainly wasn't unique, in that it was something that was kind of understood that as the war continued to grind on, that these issues became more and more important. So you've obviously given a pretty good firsthand look at this. Okay, so you're with Charlie Battery. You're going to be in fire direction. Take me through a typical day for Don Aird there with Charlie Battery. What would you typically do on a day?
Okay, first thing, we get what they call the MET. It's a metrological profile of what's going on out there. They would send a balloon up, I think it was four times a day, and every 100 meters they would give us wind direction, wind speed, up to 32,000 feet. And we put this in our computer. Now, it's pretty boring stuff, but I always did that, just give me something to do. So I'd put the MET in the computer. To get the metrological reading, we had to go to a push. Is a on a radio is your destination. What is, I don't know what's the right term for it. But it's where everybody talks in that. It's a channel. Mm-hmm. So we go to metrological push. And then, you know, all the units are up there. All the artillery units are listening to this meteorological report. Well, if you had a new recording, for instance, somebody had Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison, we'd automatically take our dial and turn it all the way to the right, and everybody would go over there and listen to Johnny Cash. Guy reading the MET would have to come in there and interrupt and try and bring us back to get this report. And we always came back. But it was the same thing every day. It was always something, Woodstock, Johnny Cash, something we'd go listen to. Mm-hmm. And we'd all come back and then get our copy down, all the wind speed and direction for the whole thing. When I'd go back, plug it in. Then we had breakfast. We had breakfast at, I suppose, 7 o'clock. Everybody would leave for breakfast except one guy. Early on, we would have insertions. 101st would be putting troops on the ground. So they would set up what they call the time on target. Mm-hmm. All the batteries that could fire on that target would fire one round, and they were all supposed to land exactly the same time. At twofold, if there was anybody there, it would kill them, but mostly was there to get the booby traps, set the booby traps off, mm-hmm. and clear foliage out, too. So almost always we had an insertion somewhere, so we'd set up our time on target, our guys would be on the guns, and we'd get her done.
Yeah, kind of a landing zone prep, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did that almost every day for somebody, not just 101st. We were core artillery, so we did it for the Arvins and for anybody else who might be around.
Okay, one of my questions was going to be just who exactly you are supporting, and obviously the 101st, I guess, would get the bulk of this. Would that be right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but
yeah,
Arvin
pretty much was up there. But if anybody else needed help, you know, we did a lot for Marine Recon, and it's this kind of out of context. But one day, what we did for Marine Recon was when they went to bed at night, there'd be six or eight of them. We'd fire around north, south, east, and west of their position, so that they could adjust the fire from there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so. Every night we're doing this one. This one we're out in at Vagel. We did this. So one night, getting ready to shoot these targets, when I realized we didn't have their position. You know, they're supposed to give us their position also besides the four targets. So I called them back within a minute shooting this thing, and the guy gave me his position. Well, that was one of the targets they sent us, and that was as close as I came as killing somebody as I did the whole tour.
Wow.
God almighty. So we got that sorted out. So we really had to watch these guys. You know, almost all that friendly fire was because the guy at the other end was not paying attention, and we could have really done some damage there, but we didn't. So we shoot for Marine recon, we got the gun ready. We never had to fire in their defense,
mm-hmm.
but we were ready to do it.
Yeah. And this would be kind of a daily thing for you, get the coordinates in, you know, bracket the Marines at night if you're working with the Marines, artillery prep, you know, for landing zones for the 101st or Arvin or whoever may be in service at the time. So you have all this to begin your day, where you're going to go, what you're going to do. Take me through the rest of the day. Are there going to be multiple preps in a day? Are you going to, you know, be responsible for, okay, we prep this landing zone so for this outfit, now we're going to do this outfit here. What else is going on during the course of the day?
Okay, the rest of the targets, they would send in grids. What a grid was, it would be a 4x4. You shoot four rounds in four targets, or a 5x5 or a 6x5, 6x6. So 4x4 is 16 rounds, 5x5 is 25, and 6x6 is 36 rounds. So they'd grid an area they wanted you to shoot, and we get those targets early on. We'd shoot them later after we got done with the landing zones.
Mm-hmm.
So we're shooting a lot of these grids like that. If there was a forward observer out there, which there was from time to time, and he had a target, then we'd shoot his target, and we'd adjust the rounds till we got done with what we're doing. Trying to think if there's anything else. Just the odd things that happened. I missed this. I was on R&R, but there's a river running down the DMZ called Benoit,
mm-hmm.
Benhoy, whatever it is. And somebody spotted a sampan out there when we were at Charlie 2. They gave us a fire mission. We fired one round. The Cobras wanted the target. They called us off. One round, we hit the target. We hit this sampan dead on. Just a miracle. It's actually got a record of it that we did this thing.
It'd be difficult, yeah.
Yeah, just odd things like that would come up, and we'd shoot those targets. Well, I was not there, but elephants were legitimate targets.
And would you explain why?
Okay, an elephant, there was no wild elephants in Vietnam. So anytime they found an elephant out there, it was like the deuce and a half for the Vietnamese. They used them to carry supplies and weapons around Vietnam. So any elephant was spotted was a legitimate target, and we did our best to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
It did not happen on, you know, when I was there, but our battery actually killed an elephant at one point before I ever came to country.
Yeah. So you're getting these initially prepping these LZs, then you're getting these other targets that you're firing on, and you're doing this. You're on a 12-hour shift, it sounds like, 4:30 to 4:30 there. All right, so what is the pace of your day like? I mean, obviously, some days you're going to be busier than others. Sometimes you're going to have LZs to prep. Other times you may not have them. You might have other targets that you have to acquire and fire on. So take me through what else is going on during the day. I mean, if you're not firing, are you working on reports? Are you listening to music? Are you, you know, what's chow like? Tell me about all that.
Okay. When we're not doing that, we're all figuring out what we're going to do when we come home.
Hmm.
We got a bunch of catalogs for electronics, for instance. We got catalogs for photography. I don't know if anybody's talked to you about the Paysex catalog.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
This is a really big deal for us. A group of military wives in Japan back during the Korean War set up this exchange. So they send you a catalog, and you can order stuff from that catalog. Through Japan, they'd send it home. So they have electronics in there. You could buy all kinds of stereo equipment, which is what I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy cameras. For instance, there was a Canon FTQL. That's what I bought in 1970. It had a f1.2 lens, which I was told was really... I never bought a camera before. But I could buy that for $200. So I took my first paycheck, and I ordered a camera for Vietnam so I could take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done through Paysex. But they sold China, for instance, Noritake China, like plates and dishes and things like that. They sold a lot of that stuff. So I would get my Paysex catalog out. When I got paid, then two things I'd do. I'd buy film for my camera, and I'd buy soda, Now, one of the things I take a lot of heat about from other veterans is we had a small refrigerator that had been purchased sometime before I got there. So we had cold soda if you wanted it. So I'd get a couple of cases of soda, I'd get a couple of rolls of film, and the rest of it I'd send, buy stuff off of Paysex, which was this exchange out of Japan. When I'd put an order in, they would send, everything else went to the United States. My dad would pick it up. Sometimes there would be a customs charge, sometimes it wouldn't, depending on who was in the post office at the time. He was a veteran. I got it free. If it wasn't, then I had to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm looking at that stuff. We're trying to figure out what to do when you get out. So I was looking at a graduate school. We played a lot of cards, hearts, and bridge. Really wasn't much else to do. We had to be there. We had to be on right there where the radios were. But there was a lot of downtime, so we did a lot of other things besides just shooting missions.
Yeah. What other sort of things would you guys be doing?
Oh, we had some goofy things. I found this. We got all these insects. Insects were so much a part of our lives. Roaches, millions of roaches. If you had, for instance, I came in country, I got a piece of candy. I didn't eat it all, sat in my pocket for breakfast. When I got up in the morning, I put my hand in there, I came out covered with roaches.
Hmm.
So you couldn't leave anything like that. They would actually eat through the cigarette packs, they'd eat through the metal and get into the tobacco. Roaches were just unbelievable. They were everywhere. The other thing was the rats. We had, I can't even guesstimate how many rats we had. We were just literally overrun with rats. Rats were everywhere. Sometimes they get in your bunks. One night, I had a piece of candy. It was still wrapped, hanging on the wall. This rat climbed up the wall, knocked the candy out, and drug it in a hole before I catch up to him.
Huh.
Oh, it's unbelievable. At night, we didn't get anything to eat. We had sea rations, and we'd sneak in the mess hall because they had big cans of juice. So we'd go in there and get some juice and bring it back. We turned the light on, the tables, everything was covered with rats, and rats would scoot, they'd be gone, then you'd go get your whatever you needed.
Mm-hmm.
When we got up to Charlie 2, which is on the DMZ, the last fire base I was at, I was just 2 weeks from going home, I went in that chow hall and turned the lights on, and the rats didn't move. They just looked at me. And you had the feeling that if you went in there, they would jump you. So I turned the lights off, and I got out of there, because I didn't need that. I didn't need juice that bad.
Right.
Okay, so you got rats and roaches, and you got all these other insects. We had praying mantises that were 8 inches long. Well, we also had spiders, and I found a spider, and I found out that the spider could kill all these other spiders. So I'm just playing around, not having anything else to do. So I'd make a wager with somebody, and they'd pick a bigger spider, but the spider's really good. He'd go over and zap them. So then I became Spider-Man. This little spider, I couldn't keep up with him. He finally got away from me.
Yeah.
But you're kind of bored. You're talking about home. What I tried not to do is look ahead. I didn't look ahead. They had what they call the short-timers calendar. You may have heard about this.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost always a profile of a very attractive woman, and it was divided into 365 days, and they were all over. So you went through a day, you'd color in the day. Well, that seemed counterproductive to me. So I didn't look ahead. I didn't look ahead for anything. Not my R&R, anything. The first sergeant came up to me one day and he said, you know, you got to have an R&R. Okay, so when do you want to do it? I said, well, when's the last day I can do it, still get away with it? That's how I worked this thing. I wanted to keep everything, so I wasn't looking ahead to the end.
Yeah. And is that some sort of, I don't know, self-defense mechanism where you just, you know, you don't want to focus on what's coming up. You want to focus on the day that you're at right now. What I'm doing today, we'll worry about tomorrow when tomorrow comes.
Exactly. I just towards September of 1970, we were still out at Vagel. It's the end of the road. The monsoons are coming. I can tell because we get that MET report, and all of a sudden all the winds lined up. Top to bottom, all coming from the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I know this is coming, and we're not moving. And then I really started to panic, because if started raining, we couldn't get out of there. We'd be there until March of next year, and we're supposed to be out of there in September.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, we got out before it came.
Yeah. How long did you spend out there at GLA?
GLA, I was in and out of there several times. There was next to battalion, they had it set up so we'd bring one of our artillery batteries in there, and from time to time, everybody staged out of GLA. So we left, went from Sally, that was in January. We moved back in March to GLA, and let's see, we spent Easter at GLA. In May, we moved from GLA to Fire Support Base Bagel. That's this one out by the Ashaw Valley.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one we spent the whole summer out there. We came back from Bagel. We stopped at GLA again. So every time we did something, we sort of went back through GLA. So we'd spend a week there, 2 weeks, and then we'd move on.
Now, I know at one point you are you're supporting Fire Support Base Ripcord. And this,
that was all of the summer of 1970. That was out of Bagel.
Yeah, and so you're at Bagel when all this is taking place. Obviously, Ripcord, very, very famous or infamous, depending on how you want to look at it, what was going on there at Ripcord, especially in July of 1970 with the siege and the preparation and the siege of Ripcord there. What can you tell me about the support here at Ripcord?
Okay, we were firing 24 hours a day on Ripcord. We had two 175s and we had two 8-inches. So the 175 is the only gun that would reach there. We went through two tubes where we had to change the tubes before we could continue to fire. It was a nightmare. On the phone with these guys, they're begging us to shoot, and we're shooting as fast as we can. We had a chaplain come through, and he had been out there, and he said there's a radar tracking 320 active NVA sites around Ripcord.
Mm.
And he said it was horrendous. You want to do everything you could for those guys. There was never a time when we failed to get the mission shot. But it seemed really futile at the same time.
How so?
Because there was so much going on. 320 active sites, maybe we're firing on two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really not really clear how much good we were doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like it would have been just incredibly frenetic kind of pace there, constant firing 24 hours a day. So you went through, had changed two tubes while there. So that right there indicates an awful lot of firing taking place.
Yeah, and we had to get those rounds up there. You know, it was never a time when we didn't have something to shoot, but mm-hmm. it was close a couple times.
Yeah. How aware were you of what was going on there at Ripcord, just the desperation of the situation there?
We had Stars and Stripes was doing a series on that at the time, and we were following as close as we could. We're trying to figure out why they were the lowest point. I mean, everything was, they were in an area where they're surrounded by higher points. You know, that's always bad, because anybody shooting down you, so they got the advantage.
Sure.
We're trying to figure out why they picked that spot. But you're just busy, you know, you're just shooting.
Yeah. So you're at Bagel when this takes place. How long were you going to be there? You say the entire summer of 1970?
Yeah, we got there in May, late last week, last 10 days of May, and we stayed through to the middle of September.
Mm-hmm. So the siege is obviously, well, I won't say the siege is lifted, but the folks there at Ripcord are eventually pulled out.
Yeah.
Obviously. Did you ever have a chance an opportunity to speak with any of these guys who were there at Ripcord, other than over the phone?
No, I do it through their website. That's all I had, but... Yeah, oh my God, this Keith Nolan's from St. Louis did a book on it.
Yes.
What I couldn't figure out was, when I got home, I was trying to find something written about it, and there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I knew this was going on, but if you look at Time or Newsweek or any newspaper, we didn't have the internet. I just couldn't find anything about Ripcord. I was really puzzled why that what happened there.
Hmm, interesting.
Because the year before, we had been shooting at Hamburger Hill. I wasn't there for that. From an adjacent base, and at Hamburger Hill, had all that coverage, and everybody knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So next year, the exact same thing happened with the same people, but you couldn't find anything about it.
Hmm. I wonder if that would have been just a lack of media interest in it, or if it were was the Army trying to maybe play down what was going on at Ripcord. So, you know, because the Hamburger Hill obviously was a Dongapia was a was a public relations nightmare, given what was going on in the United States and the anti-war sentiment and what took place there at Hamburger Hill. Perhaps that had something to do with it. I don't know.
Well, it did. They actually came out and said that they wouldn't allow any media out there.
Hmm. Okay, I didn't realize
and
that.
And we never got any at our place. I mean, no reporters or anything ever came out there.
Hmm.
So they deliberately, because they didn't want to get another black eye. I'm sure Westmoreland was pulling the strings on this one.
Yeah. Hmm. That's fascinating stuff. So you're there until September of 1970, and you say you go back to GLA after that, I guess?
Right, and then we came back up to Sally.
Mm-hmm.
And then in December, they split the battery, half stayed at Sally and the 175s. And I went to Nancy, which is next, a couple bases up. We had a... the Army is so strange the way they operate. It's just unbelievable. We sent our 8-inch guns on a raid in November. They drove the guns. These are old tracks. They shouldn't have been driven, number one. Raid is just a game that our colonel was playing. He took our 2 8-inches to Birmingham, which is another base that our B battery was on. So they had all these 8-inches out in front of Birmingham, and we shot prearranged targets, I don't know what it was, 40 rounds. And then both guns broke down, so they had to send out trucks to drag them back to the battery. Well, the upshot is that the higher hires, the people who ran I-Corps, had a plan where they wanted our 175s to go to Nancy a month earlier, but they couldn't do that now that the guns are broken down. They didn't know we were doing this raid. So it's a big screw-up all the way around. So Finally they got the guns back up, and then they moved the 175s up to Nancy, and we were covering somebody else up there.
Mm-hmm.
So the battery split.
Yeah. While all this is going on, I mean, your first-person account here, what do you know and what are your thoughts on the way the war is being prosecuted at this time? Are you satisfied that they're going about it the right way? Are you convinced that the Arvin is taking over appropriately for the role they're going to play for the remainder of the war? What did you know about the way the war was being fought, and what was your opinion of it?
Well, first of all, the big thing for us was that all these units were going home, and we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Marines had all left by then. The Big Red One had gone home. You know, seemed like every month another unit went home, and the Arvins were moving in. We've got Arvins pulling our security when we came back to Sally, and they were not doing a good job. I think we could have been overrun at any time if the NVA or the VC wanted to come through at Sally, because these guys just were non-existent. So you're really concerned about all this stuff. Ripcord is over, but looks like we're getting out. In fact, I think Nixon said in 68 he was going to get us out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's 1970. Is he getting us out now, or is it going to be... You don't want to be the last guy there, okay? Everybody's
right.
Thinking you don't want to be the last guy there. We had a duster with us at Sally there in November, December. A duster is a twin 40-millimeter gun on a track, and it's lethal. The VC, NVA hated these things. Well, this duster was a self-contained unit. There was 5 guys, and the rest of their unit had gone home. Okay, so we got 5 guys with no one to report to.
Hmm.
All right, so these guys, I had a picture, and I can't find it anymore. They wore Hawaiian shirts. They would go to this village next to Sally. They had hooch maids. At night, they'd go set up, and they would actually shoot. They were, they're very active at night. But during the day, they had quarts of whiskey and beer, and they ate our food. We fed them. But that was it. They had nobody to report to. It was just such a bizarre thing. It's like that bridge. What was that? That movie. Can't think of it now. With Marlon Brando and Charlie Sheen.
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse
yes.
Now.
Yes.
If you remember that movie that they had this bridge they were fighting for, nobody knew. Nobody was in charge. They're just every night they go out and shoot it up. Well, that's kind of what this duster was doing. But they had no one to report to. Just really bizarre. Okay, so that was going on. We had our guys trying to get out as fast as they can. It kind of, when it came back in November, we had three guys OD on heroin.
Wow. So it wasn't just marijuana.
That was scary.
Yeah. Huh.
So I found the first one. He was sitting on a latrine with a needle sticking out of his arm. All before this was just marijuana. Our medic said that they were now selling heroin on the streets as we came through town and needles. And you could buy a small container of heroin, like a coffee creamer, for 80 cents. And it was pure heroin. And he said with these guys, the problem was that they'd never been encountered pure heroin before. It wasn't cut with anything. So now we got first guy, we get him. We had to keep him in the fire direction center. You had to wake him up every half hour because if you didn't, their heart would stop and they'd die. So when he could tell us his name, they sent a helicopter out and he was gone. Then the next two showed up. At this point, I really panicked myself. I thought, you know, this is even worse than anything that's happened up to this point. Those are the last two. So we got those two guys sorted out. Well, the first guy went home. The Army didn't do anything with him. They sent him home. And 3 days after he got back in New York City, he died. So they sent us something about this. Our chief of smoke went to this guy. They didn't pack up his stuff or anything, you know, just sent him home. So the chief of smoke brought all his personal stuff in. We're going to mail it back to his family. He had a tape recorder. And we listened to the tape, last tape he did. He was sending this to his brother. And he's talking about all the great marijuana they had. And he said, now, he said, we got heroin. He says, only 80 cents of whatever. And he was showing no animosity towards the NCOs or the battery commander or anybody. He understood that they had to get after him for this stuff. But he was really excited about this heroin. And he had all this. The guy is already dead, and you're listening to this. And it's really spooky.
Yeah. What kind of effect does this have within the unit? I mean, you've got a few guys who are overdosed on heroin now. You mentioned the marijuana problem. You mentioned the racial issues. You talked about, hey, everybody else is going home, but we're not going home. How does morale evolve during this time?
Well, they keep the guys and the guns busy. They're always cleaning, fixing, doing something. And no one's really happy being there, but it really was no open rebellion at this point. But in the fire direction center, you're thinking, well, now, in the fire direction center, we made a decision that we weren't going to drink or smoke anything, okay, because we could kill somebody. That was our decision that, when I get home, I'll drink all the beer I want. But as long as I'm here, I'm not going to drink or do anything.
Yeah.
But on the battery, there's a lot of people not. If you weren't smoking, you were drinking. You were drinking beer, and drinking a lot of it. And some of those guys got tanked every night. So it was really hard to distinguish between somebody high on marijuana and high on beer. But during the work day, the drinkers were working, but the smokers they tended not to do anything but to smoke.
I would assume that would make it more difficult for those of you who chose to abstain from these kinds of behaviors.
It did, but they, for whatever reason, those guys and the guns did not. I would never have put up with it. I would have done something, but they somehow. It's almost like they looked at them as being heroes. You know, they were like the MASH guys.
Yeah.
Counterculture heroes, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretty much let them alone.
That's really interesting, given the kinds of problems, especially when you have people who are overdosing. that would be kind of hard to wrap your head around, I would think.
Yeah, I don't know what they thought about the overdosing, but just a guy, you know, they just didn't seem to be bothered.
Hmm. You mentioned a moment ago the Arvin, whether it was supporting the Arvin or the Arvin in charge of the defense of the unit there at the base. What was your opinion? I mean, did you have any contact with the Vietnamese armed forces? What was your opinion of them and the way they were fighting the war?
Well, we never had to deal with that. I never talked to a Vietnamese the whole time I was in country, either Arvins or civilians.
Hmm.
I was either on a fire support base or I was going to and from. And my in-country R&R I did in Da Nang at China Beach, and I just never met any of them. I just never had any contact at all with them.
Hmm. What sort of things did you pick up about their behavior, the way they were fighting the war? I mean, are other guys talking about the Vietnamese? Oftentimes you hear people say, hey, those guys, you know, they weren't in it, you know, to win the thing. They were, you know, they kind of slacked off. They avoided contact. You hear other people say, hey, I worked with the Vietnamese and they were as good as anybody else out there. What was your opinion, whether it was scuttlebutt or what have you? What was your opinion of the Vietnamese in general?
Now, the overriding opinion is that they had terrible leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think individually they're no different than I was. But
yeah,
they had no their leadership. They weren't even on the field at the time. They were always somewhere else or back in Saigon or something. When we called in fire missions, for instance, we had to really be careful, the guy making the call, that we weren't going to shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have very good skills, like map reading.
Yeah.
So we always added an extra danger close for, I don't remember what it was anymore, we'd add another 100 meters to that before we ever fired for effect.
Hmm. Just to make sure that you're not dropping rounds on the people that you're trying to support there.
Exactly. I didn't care if they were Vietnamese or what. I didn't want to kill anybody I wasn't supposed to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's obviously stands to reason there. Hmm. You mentioned that you had an in-country R&R at Da Nang. When did that take place?
Okay, that I pushed everything up. So that was up in January of 1971.
Okay, so it's pretty late.
I had a three-day R&R.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that R&R.
Well, the first mistake, there's between Phu Bai and Da Nang, there's something called the Hai Van Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I'd like to see that Hai Van Pass. So what I did was I packed my suitcase, and in Vietnam, if you wanted to ride, what you did was you found a MP, and you say to the MP, I need a ride to, in this case, was Da Nang. So the MP just started stopping vehicles till he found one, and he put me on it, and it happened to be a part of a two-truck convoy.
Hmm.
And the way these truckers ran it, they had a truck that was full of whatever they were trucking, and there was an empty truck. And the empty truck pushed the full truck up over the Hai Van Pass. That's the way this worked. And I knew nothing about any of this. So I got on the truck, and we're going up the Hai Van Pass, and all of a sudden this guy's on the other guy's bumper. He's got his head out the window, and he's holding fingers up, telling what gear he's in. Because they want to get over that pass as fast as they can. It's pretty steep up there. But it's also a windy road, so we're sliding off the bumper towards the edge of this thing. scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
We get to the top. All of a sudden, there's a six-round. There's a 105 or 155 battery fired six rounds to our right, about 100 meters. And now I'm really concerned because there must be something going on I don't know about.
Right.
The trucker gives me a 16, and he gives me a bandolier ammunition. He has me load, get ready, just in case something happens. Well, nothing ever happened. We got over the pass. We got in there. That was the last time I did anything like that. I flew from then on. I could fly. I'd soon fly.
Right, right, yeah.
All right. So they get us in there. The in-country R&R, you get all the food. You can go in and get food. They have movies going on. You can go into Da Nang. China Beach is right there. When I go into Da Nang, the MPs are all over me. They're asking for my orders. And every time I turn around, there's another MP asking me for my orders. And pretty soon I got really tired of that. They had a big PX at Freedom Hill. I went up there and bought a suitcase and some other stuff. And I came back, and I never left compound where on China Beach then. It was, wasn't a nice day or anything, but I get out on the beach. It was kind of fun to walk around.
Mm-hmm.
And I could wear civilian clothes. But going into town, man, the MPs made it impossible to do anything.
Yeah. Do you think that's a reflection of just the trouble they've had in the past or just trying to, you know, perhaps clamp down on anything, you know, to really make sure that the people who were supposed to be there were there and those who weren't there? Do you think that's what it was?
Yeah, it was all the AWOLs they had. They just, I can't even describe all the different people that had been AWOL just kind of living around Da Nang. You know, they're GIs, maybe 3, 4, 6 months out. I'd meet them on the street. They'd try and get some money so they'd get something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
It's like panhandling.
Wow.
But it was right there in Da Nang.
Yeah. So what else do you do when you're there on R&R?
I just kind of wander around. It was only 3 days, but I saw some movies, and that was it.
Yeah.
I really wanted to go into Da Nang and see stuff, but it was impossible.
Yeah. Kind of discouraged you from that with all the red tape and all of those sort of things, I guess, yeah. Very interesting. Now, were you able to take an out-of-country R&R?
Yeah, I went to Sydney, and that was in early March, 1971.
Now, why did you choose Sydney?
I always wanted to go to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
All my life I wanted to go to Australia, and there I get paid to go to Australia.
Right. No-brainer then, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about Sydney. What was that like in 71?
Oh, my gosh. It was heaven. It was better than the States. It was, I can't even describe it. Everybody liked you. I couldn't get over how friendly they were. And every time you talk to them, you say, you guys are just so friendly. So, oh, we're not near as friendly as somebody else, Perth or some other place. Any place I went, people were glad to see me. I'm trying to think. I took a taxi ride, and I wanted to see Sydney. So I said, let's go here, let's go here. Pretty soon the driver got mad at me. I said, what's the matter? He says, well, I can only charge you one rate. He said, I can only charge you $2.50. I said, oh, come on now. We'll work this out. I said, you tell me how much it costs, and we're going to drive around Sydney. So I spent about half a day driving around. I think it cost me $30. What a great place that was.
Yeah.
Now, I intended to immigrate to Australia. So I was doing some checking, too. I went to see what the jobs were. I was a high school teacher, so I went to see what the teachers were paid. $5,000 a year, which is less than I was getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
The cars were selling, and this is really an eye-opener for me. Back in 1970, 71, Buicks were selling for $3,500 in the States. In Sydney, there was $12,500 for this car.
Holy smokes.
And I realized, you know, if I'm teaching school, I'll never have a car.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to give up the idea of moving there. But I really, really would have done it if there was some way I could have made it happen.
Yeah, it sounded like it really made an impression on you.
Oh, yeah. Everybody, you can't even tell you how. No garbage. You know, you walk down the streets of the United States back then, there was garbage everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't find a cigarette butt on the ground in Sydney,
mm-hmm.
anywhere. I just loved the place.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard other veterans tell me that when they went on their out-of-country R&R, that sometimes it was difficult for them to go back, knowing that they had, you know, a third of their tour left or half of their tour left. But you, I guess, had the foresight to push it off until the end.
Yeah, I only had 2 or 3 weeks left when I came back. That was the plan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like it worked out pretty well for you.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Aird, why don't we go ahead and stop there for today? That takes us to a good point to stop, and we can pick it up again in the future.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krieger, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Don Aird. Today is 16 April 2014. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Aird is joining me by telephone again from his home in Fenton, Missouri. Mr. Aird, before we turn the recorder on, you were beginning to talk about the drug issue, marijuana issue again. Would you please pick up with that?
Yeah. It was so much a part of life in the battery. You know, they were smoking all the time. You could smell it. You go in the latrine, you could smell it. Because we're on 24 hours a day, when we had a little slack time, like 3 in the morning, we go take our showers. we had a shower, probably a 500-gallon tank, that they heated with an immersion heater. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
I am, but if someone wasn't, could you describe it and how it worked?
It's really unique. It's really clever the way they did this. It's like a hollow donut with a stack coming out of the donut. The donut sits in the water, and they drip gasoline into this and put a match to it. So there's a little fire going inside the donut, and it really does a great job heating the water. So before we had anybody went to get a shower, we'd go climb up, start the fire, and then about an hour later go take the shower. You know, it's just guys out there, so all I had was my shower shoes and a towel and a bar of soap, and it's probably 100 meters to the shower. Two-thirds of the way to the shower, I heard someone drop the bolt on an M16. Mm. You know, it's pitch black, and there's no sound, and you hear this. And I started talking. I was trying to tell them I wasn't Vietnamese or all the way into the shower. I didn't know where it came from. Once I got into the shower, there were three guys there smoking marijuana, and they thought I was one of the sergeants trying to sneak up on them.
Hmm.
One of them was from the Fire Direction Center. He was one we inherited from another unit. He didn't do any of the work. I was really disappointed in him, but I got my shower and I went back. I was really steaming. There's nothing you could do, but I was scared to death there for the longest period of time. And again, it's all about this damn marijuana.
Yeah, and you mentioned before that in the fire direction team that it really wasn't prevalent as much as it was perhaps in the batteries.
Yeah, none of them did except this one guy, and like I say, we inherited him. He didn't do any of the work. He just sat in the fire direction center. But, it's one of the times I almost got killed, again, it was by my own people.
Now, as you look back on that, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, that's a pretty wild situation to be in there.
Yeah, it's impossible to work like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the last thing you expect at 3 in the morning when no one else is moving is three guys in the shower smoking pot. The whole issue of men smoking that marijuana out in those fire bases, it was really detrimental to the whole operation.
Yeah, I would think so. And like you said, you really didn't see any effort to deal with it at this point in the war there.
No, in fact, you know, one of the really unique things that happened, I didn't see it, but our lieutenant did. One of our lieutenants went back to the rear, and every time he had a discipline problem from the batteries, A, B, and C, we were Charlie Battery, we would send the discipline problem back to battalion. Mm-hmm. And what battalion did was they put them all in the transportation. So they had all these, you know, people that didn't fit in anywhere, all these guys smoking marijuana and, you know, just people you didn't want to work with were all in one unit. And the lieutenant in charge of that unit was a genius. I still admire this guy. Lieutenant Freeman went back there and talked to this guy. He said, well, how do you deal with all these guys? They're pot smokers. They're, you know, useless people. How do you get them to do anything? And what he did was he got an agreement with them. They wouldn't do anything during the work hours, 8 to 5. When they were done working, he lined them all up, and he gave them marijuana, those that smoked, and he gave the others alcohol that needed something to drink, and they let them go. And he did this every night. Hmm. So the next day, they were relatively sober and could function. They did their job, and at night he rewarded them with marijuana and alcohol. So it was pretty interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, that is certainly a unique way to go about the business there. I guess the job is to get the job done, regardless of what it takes to get it done.
Yeah.
But I've never encountered anyone who has told me that before. That is really interesting.
Yeah, and again, it was Lieutenant Freeman, which he was our fire direction officer, and he's a pretty straight dude. I'm sure that's exactly how they did it.
Yeah.
Well, and there was another incident. I did forget this. Back when we moved back to GLA just before we went out to Vagel. One of our lieutenants, a guy we called Whiskey Bravo, Wonder Boy, he'd screwed up a couple times, and he shot early on a time on target and nearly hit some Cobra helicopters.
Hmm.
And he locked and loaded his .45 and walked around. He was in the hut unloaded. No one he was holding his weapon when he came to the fire direction center. They took it away from him, and they unloaded it. So we had this guy got a hold of what is these starlight scopes. I'm sure you've heard the starlight scope described.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing that gathers light and you can see in the dark. It's a, you get a, you know, get a green image, you can see pretty good. And he said to me one night, he said, Aird, he said, pick up your M16, I want you to come with me. So we're walking, and there's a group of guys out there in the field about a quarter mile from where we were, and we walked up to them, and they were smoking marijuana. And he wanted me to arrest all these guys. Well, there's 10 of them, and they're all armed. So I managed to get him turned around. I managed to get him back without anybody getting killed. And I went back up to the battery commander, and I told him he had to take that starlight scope away from this lieutenant, or he's going to get somebody killed.
Huh. Well, that's an issue that just seems to keep coming up over and over again with you, isn't
it? Oh, yeah. When you start thinking about all the different incidents, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Now, obviously, this incident heading to the latrine and hearing someone charge their M16 was obviously a pretty frightening kind of experience. What about the bravest thing that you saw there? What, was there anything that really stands out to you, one particular incident or a number of incidents of seeing guys, Americans or Vietnamese, in action that you stood back and said, my goodness, I just can't, that's one of the bravest things I've seen.
Yeah, there was one in particular. In fact, it's another one of those things that back up. When we first moved up to Vagel, we had didn't construct our bunkers yet, so we're sleeping out in the ground. I managed to put my cot underneath a large trailer. It was a great big thing. It was two wheels, and my bunk just fit under there. So I wasn't worried about getting hit or shot or anything. I just didn't want to get wet. About midnight, there was this flash, like somebody took a flashbulb and shot in my face. And seconds later, this huge explosion, and then all kinds of stuff started falling on this two-wheel trailer. And right away, everybody's up, and we're moving around, and we found out that a mortar, one of ours, had shot a short round, and ended up in a ammo dump right in front of the 155 unit, which is about the middle of Vagel. Two dozer operators, two guys running D8s that had built the hill, got in their dozers, and they're trying to smother the fire. One of the dozers got over some dynamite, whatever, and he muffled the explosion. It blew the dozer off the hill, killed the driver, and killed one other guy on guard duty. And this guy that drove the dozer had less than 3 weeks to do in country. He didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
It's probably the bravest thing I'd ever seen. Of course, he was killed.
Wow.
Now, Keith and I, my partner, sat down. We figured if he hadn't done that, if the 155 battery had gone up with that ammo dump, the whole hill would have gone with it. So we tried to find out who this guy was. Well, they left where I was, an engineering group. They were building these hills all over Vietnam. And we could never figure out who this guy was. So you guys at Texas Tech have a thing called, or used to have a thing called, Lost and Found. Are you familiar with that?
Sort of. It's something that kind of ebbed and flowed a little bit.
Right. Well, I got on Lost and Found, and they've got one for the Army, Marines, Air Force, Navy. I went on the Army one, and I was looking for some of our guys, and I found a couple, but mostly I was trying to find out who this guy was that had sacrificed himself like that. And I think it was like 30 years later, one of the guy that was on the other D8 contacted me via email and told me that the guy that was killed was a guy by the name of Frank Martin Mebbs, M-E-B-B-S. So I went up on the virtual wall, and it really was nothing about the incident, just that he was killed. So I wrote a letter to his family, and I explained everything that had happened. And the family gave that letter to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and then one of their reporters called me, and they did a story on this.
Hmm.
And it turns out all the Army said was that he was killed. They didn't say anything about it. And the first they knew about how he actually died was this letter I sent them. And family never contacted me.
Hmm.
Okay, but the newspaper did, and they did the story. And I'll find a copy of that, and I'll send that on, too. That was really, it made all the difference to everybody on that hill. And the Army really gave him no credit for it. I don't really think he got any kind of medal or anything.
Huh. That's really kind of odd, but I guess probably not surprising. A small thing for someone back home would be such a huge thing for someone who was over there to experience this, to have someone sacrifice themselves, for the unit, for the greater good, just to do what was right rather than worry about his own personal protection. That's really incredible.
Oh, it really was. And except for him and this one other guy, there were maybe 30 people trying to fight that fire, and they were wounded, but no one else died. I mean, Frank saved them all. Hmm. And Keith and I, we talked about that a lot. You still there?
Yes, sir. I'm still here. I'm sorry.
Okay, I was trying to think if there was anything else. Actually, there really wasn't anything else where you saw anything kind of bravery like that.
Yeah.
Was that just that one incident?
Yeah, at least the one that sticks in your mind right now, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about some of the leadership, whether it was the leadership of your lieutenant, the fire direction control officer. What was your opinion of the American military leadership there, specifically for your outfit and in general, the higher leadership?
We had five battery commanders. Their very first one, he was a West Point graduate, but he was kind of a bean counter. He didn't want to do anything, but he wanted to get all his numbers correct. So every morning we had to go down to, it was a mile to his hooch at GLA, and we had to write them rounds we fired anything else that came up that night. And he had to put the date on this thing, and I always forgot the date. So he'd call us up, and I'd have to march down there and put the date on his little board. And he'd go back to battalion, and he would tell him what was going on. After him, we got a whole bunch. We had four really good battery commanders, guys that really cared about what we did, and they were very good. We had a Captain Casino, Captain Sloan, and I don't really remember the names of the others, but the two, Casino and Sloan, were ones that really stood out, really good leaders. Our fire direction officers, we had Whiskey Bravo, we had Wonder Boy, and he wasn't good at anything. But then we had Lieutenant Freeman, who was excellent. He was a math teacher, and he worked the fire missions with us. He was, I can't even tell you how good this guy was. He was just super. And then we had a 19-year-old lieutenant. His name is James Engstrom. We call him Tango Bravo, Teeny Bopper, when he came in.
Hmm.
And he was really good. He was, in fact, 19 years old. He was intimidated by the other officers. So what he would do is he'd go to the mess with us, and he'd put on one of our hats, Spec 4, Spec 3. So he was trying to blend in with the enlisted men because the officers intimidated him. You know, they're all quite a bit older than he was.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys were, we had no problem that way. Whiskey Bravo did one more thing that we didn't, when the biggest thing that you didn't want to do, you didn't want to shoot out. Now, you're familiar with the term shoot out for artillery?
I am, but could you explain it to someone who might not be?
Okay, when you shoot out means you're shooting other than where you're supposed to be shooting. Okay, so we had two of those instances. One was, both at Bagel. Okay, the very first one, we had another lieutenant on the firing battery. The lieutenant on the firing battery and the chief of smoke were the ones that pointed the guns. We'd give them an azimuth, and then they would set the gun on that azimuth. One day we were shooting in the Ashaw Valley. There was a bunch of targets we'd been given, and we had a forward observer come on. He was going to adjust our fire. So the very first round he looked for, he couldn't see. He said it must have been in the jungle. So he started giving us 1,000-meter corrections till he get it out to where he could see it.
Hmm.
Well, in the middle of all this, this lieutenant came running in from the firing battery, and he said, I've laid us out 500 mils. Now, the way the artillery works, there's circles 360 degrees, but for artillery battery, that's broken to 6,400 mils. So what he did is he laid us out right at a right angle to where we should have been shooting. Our Lieutenant Freeman called a check fire, He told the Four Observer, we're going to change rounds. We think maybe there's a problem with our rounds. We have several batches of shells. Each batch comes with a number. And he said, we're going to change to a different number. In the meantime, that lieutenant went back out there and got the gun pointed in the right direction. So we fired the first round. The Four Observer said, I see it. He said, I'll adjust from there. The upshot is we covered for this lieutenant, but the Army ended up dumping all those shells with that code, and I couldn't tell you how many that would have been. And then from then on, we were writing all the codes for the powder and the shell on each fire direction sheet. We hadn't been doing that before, but now we were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the second one where we fired out was this Lieutenant Whiskey Bravo. He was less than a week to go before he's going home, and he's looking around outside, and he saw a light on a mountain about maybe 10,000 meters from where we were. He tried to get battalion to let him shoot it, and they wouldn't do it. They said, we weren't going to waste any shells on this. Well, this went on two nights. The third night, we're outside the fire direction center when the gun next to us, the 175, was fired. This shook everybody up because we were the ones who were supposed to tell it to shoot. So
yeah.
We ran out there to see what's going on. And here's Lieutenant Whiskey Bravo standing on the gun. He got permission from the guy that ran the hill, the King of the Hill, 101st Colonel, to shoot this mission. He didn't get it from us, but he got it from somebody else. And what he was doing is looking down the barrel. It's called bore sighting.
Mm-hmm.
And he was firing. In the third round, he fired, missed the mountain, just went way the hell and gone. We have no idea where it went. So we gave it a check fire, and then this guy disappeared until he went home.
Huh.
He could have hurt somebody. We don't have
yeah.
no idea.
So it sounds like it's not surprising. You have some very good leaders, some who are very capable, qualified men, and others who weren't quite so much. And that's obviously not a surprise, I don't think, to anyone.
No, they don't have that much time. They don't, whether they get 8 or 10 extra weeks, and yeah.
Yeah.
So you really had a wide range of people like that.
Yeah. Well, what about the higher leadership, military leadership there, in terms of the types of strategies employed or the types of personalities that you encountered or heard about? What about the people, your field brigade commanders, things like that?
We had, especially at Vagel, because we were so far out, there was nobody else as far out as we were. We had all kinds of colonels and generals visit us, people we didn't know, just they came and went. The first one came when we were putting sandbags on our bunkers. I've got a picture of Vagel when we're building it. They put all our hooches in a trench with the top of the hooch level with the lip of the trench.
Mm-hmm.
So we started sandbagging those hooches when this general flew in, and he said, you got to stop using those sandbags. He said they cost 80 cents each. What you're going to do, he said, is you're going to go up to there's a 105 battery right above us. And 105 shells came in a wooden crate, I suppose about 3 feet long, 2 feet wide, and a foot deep, with rope handles. So you got two shells to a box, and these guys are shooting all day. So what you're going to do is get those boxes, you're going to fill them with dirt, and you're going to put them on your hooch instead of using sandbags. So everybody did that. Now, when the 175 was fired, the muzzle blast blew those boxes all over the hill. So we'd run back up till we finally ran out of boxes. We couldn't get any more boxes. So we had no overhead cover at all.
Hmm.
All right. Our chief of smoke, this Mattson, rode home. I may already have this in this narrative. And he told his wife this in passing, that we had no cover. Well, he didn't need it. Okay, we were in defilade. It'd take a hell of a good shot to hit us.
Yeah.
But his wife got panicky, and she called her congressman. And her congressman went up to the Pentagon, of all places. And it kind of trickled on down till one day Chief Smoke gets a call. He's going back to battalion. They sent a helicopter for him. And next day he came back, and he was laughing. And he said, the upshot of all this is they gave him a psychiatric reevaluation. Now, I don't know if you know if you've ever heard this before. Okay, if you get a psychiatric reevaluation as an officer, that's the end of your career.
Yeah, I would think.
Okay, but turns out it didn't hurt smoke that much. But that was what came of all the, all this stuff and not having to cover it.
Wow.
Okay, yeah. So the two generals that stood out, one was Westmoreland. General Westmoreland flew up to the hill. We had two pads. There was a pad up by us, landing pad, and there was a pad below us that they pentaprimed. I don't know if you know what pentaprime is.
Again, I'm familiar with it, but someone else may not be. Can you explain that?
Yeah, okay. So what they did was the only thing in this whole hill that gets pentaprimed is that landing zone that's down below us. It's a liquid oil they spread on, and it sort of makes, I don't know, it's really nasty stuff. It stays liquid for quite a while. You got to let it set up, and then you sort of have a like an asphalt covering, but that's the best way I could describe it. So we had that asphalt landing zone, but they kept using ours. And every time they used it, throw up this cloud of dust, but they wouldn't use that new one. And then one day I got up 4:30 for my shift, and I looked out, and there was 30 Cobra helicopters flying around our hill. And right away you panic. You think something big is coming.
Yeah, but you see 30 Cobras, you know that something's in the offing.
Yeah, we just never saw it. I never saw anything like this. So I'm in the fire direction center, and I called back to battalion, and they knew nothing about it. They didn't know what was going on. So the 101st ran the hill. They're all in full alert. You got all these helicopters flying around. And then the 105s had a round called a beehive, and I'm sure you heard of this beehive round. Mm-hmm. And there's a signal they use when they're going to shoot it, so everybody gets down. You don't want to get hit by those fouchettes. So 8 in the morning, we hear this signal. So now we're all ducking. We're ducking for cover because we think we're being overrun. And then there was another signal saying it was all clear. And a Chinook helicopter flew in and landed on this pentaprime strip. And all these cameras got off, cameras and tape recorders, maybe 10, 12 of them. And the Chinook flies away, and in comes a Slick. That's a helicopter without doors. And out jumps General Westmoreland. This first we knew he was going to be there.
Huh.
So he walks out. He's still below us. He's standing there. He's doing something with the cameras and with the recorders. And he gets back on the Slick. He flies away. The Chinook lands. The media gets in it. They fly away. And then the Cobras are all gone, just like that. It was just like they weren't there. So that was his visit to the hill. Yeah, he didn't talk to anybody anywhere except at the bottom there between us and the 105s.
Hmm.
A couple months later, General Creighton Abrams comes. Abrams comes in. It's just him and his aide and nobody else. And he walks up to the battery. And because we didn't know he was coming, we were shooting a mission with a 175. And the major that was in charge of our battalion was with him. He was trying to get the fire mission stopped, but Abrams says, no, just let them do their job. After the mission's over, fire mission's over, Abrams wants to talk to the gun crew. Now, he'd been an artillery guy. And he complimented them on their work and everything, and our guys are lined up. There's 10 of them. And they're not at attention. They're just standing there. And our major got behind Abrams, and he started imitating someone coming to attention. He did that about 3 times. When one of the guys in the end saw it, he nudged his buddy, and they started laughing. It was incredible. Anyway, Abrams said, you know, don't worry about it. He said, you guys did a great job. He said, just keep doing your work, and then he flew away. There was no reporters with him. There was no cameras. There was two entirely different people running that thing.
Real contrast in styles there, huh?
Oh, my God. It's unbelievable to see this.
Well, tell me, what are your opinions of both Abrams and Westmoreland as leaders?
Well, we don't know what you don't know anything about what's going really going on around you. Mm-hmm. Ripcord was a disaster, and we knew that. And but you don't know who's responsible for any part of this. Years later, we're talking, we get this 170th go to breakfast, and one of them was a guy with the 101st who went through the entire battle of Hamburger Hill. He was there from beginning to end. And we're talking about Weigel, and he said, well, you know, we fought for Weigel in 1968. I said, well, I thought we were the first ones up there. He said, no, we were there in 68. And if you go online and you look, put in Fire Support Base Weigel, you find out the 101st fought for it in 68 and 69. They took it, and typically they let it go, and then the NVA came back up there and took it over again. So we're looking at this thing. The importance of Weigel was it sat at the juncture of two roads out of the Asha Valley. They come together right at the base of Weigel. So by occupying Weigel the summer 1970, we closed two routes out of the Asha Valley. But no one's telling you this. You don't know any of this until you start piecing it together.
Yeah.
As far as the way the war was conducted, you know, you have no idea what's going on. You're just doing your bit.
Yeah. And, of course, that stands to reason. You've got bigger things to worry about than strategies and grand geopolitics and things like that, for sure. And the guys who were a little higher pay grade are making other decisions that you really don't have any reason to know about or to understand. I was just kind of curious, you know, having seen both of them you know, having been as observant as you were of things going on, if you had an opinion on either one of them. But I think that kind of clears it up.
Yeah. I'm sure he was more than just a media person, but it seemed like Abrams really was more interested in what was going on than how he looked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, while you're there, and again, this is kind of on the same thread here, and perhaps you don't take the time or have the time to think about it, but yeah, this war's been going on for quite a while by the time you're there in 1970, 70 into 71, and you've seen a lot of things in the news and the newspapers and the magazines and all of this sort of stuff. Do you get any sort of idea of why you're there? How it's progressing? Do you feel like this is, you know, I've heard some people say, hey, we knew it was a lost cause, you know, by 1970, and we were just wondering why we were still hanging on. What was your opinion on this after you'd been there for a while?
Yeah, it was the same for everybody. We're saying we don't want to be the last one killed. Nothing's going to be accomplished here. They keep coming back. Look, we're third time on Weigel. When we leave, they're going to come back up there and take it again. We're accomplishing nothing, but we're losing people. Mm-hmm. And now we didn't lose any people, but some of our people were killed that summer at Bastogne and at Birmingham, two other bases where the other two batteries were. Mm-hmm. And for what purpose? Ripcord happened. We shot and shot and shot. The last bird out, the captain and his XO that were in charge of that ripcord were killed. The last helicopter out was shot down. We accomplished absolutely nothing. They're still there. It's really frustrating. It becomes more frustrating when we get to Cam Low. That was at Charlie 2 right at the end of my tour. We're on the DMZ. The little village of Cam Low was selling heroin and marijuana to the guys coming through. At night, they would set a rocket up and shoot it at us. So we had a tank. We had two tanks here. The only times we had tanks, it was the Patton, I believe it was. They would be watching the village. They couldn't shoot there. It was a no-fire zone. But what they would do is they'd warn us when they were setting up the rockets for everybody to get to cover. I mean, they could actually physically see this rocket being set up, and they couldn't shoot.
Yeah, that would have to be frustrating, I would think.
I can't even describe it. I mean, this is not a way to, there's no way to do anything.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned here this is toward the end of your tour. And you come home in, I guess it's March, I think, of 1971.
Yeah, about the 20th, I guess.
Yeah, okay, so it's kind of mid to late March in 71. Are there any other incidents or things that you would like to bring up, any topics you'd like to discuss before we start bringing you back home from Vietnam?
Well, there was one. Okay, this is kind of a funny thing that happened. There's, we're from all over the United States. We had a kid there from Arkansas, and the sergeant major was from Texas, and he was from trying to think where it was, Wichita Falls, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And Texas and Arkansas were number one, number two in the nation for football. And Texas had a guy by the name of Wooster, a big running back, that came from Wichita Falls. And whenever Wooster scored a touchdown, people from Texas would yell, "Woo, woo, Wooster," like it was a crane signal. I don't know if you ever heard a horn. You pull on the left, make him motion like he's pulling on this cord, right. "Woo, woo, Wooster." So he got a hold of this kid from Arkansas. He made a bet with him, $10, that Texas beat Arkansas. And the game was played. Texas won. And he came in. He started rubbing it in, okay? It wasn't just enough he got the $10, but he started this "woo, woo, Wooster" stuff. And my friend Keith and I got ticked off, and we said, "Wait till Notre Dame plays him in the Cotton Bowl." So he said, "You want to make a bet?" And we said, "Yes, we did." So we each bet $10 that Notre Dame would beat Texas. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the battery is split. They sent our 2175s up to Nancy, and the 2 8-inch guns stayed at Sally with the first sergeant. 3 o'clock in the morning, Keith wakes me up. He said, "Notre Dame has beaten Texas." So I got up, and we listened to the rest of the game. In the game, Wooster fumbles a bunch of times. So we win our money. We call back to Sally, and first sergeant's right there. He said, "I already sent a Jeep with your money." Okay, so he comes back. So we get back together again. Every time I see him, I go, "Woo, Wooster." Well, I went to Sydney. I was going to R&R there.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Aird, you got to get a haircut before I sign your orders." I said, "First sergeant, I'm going to Sydney." I said, I don't want to look like, you know, I don't want to have my head shaved like that. And he looked at me and said, "Woo, woo, Wooster." So payback is great. So
yeah.
That's the only other one.
I assume that you indeed then did get your haircut.
Yeah. But I deserved it.
Small price to pay, I guess, all things
considered. Yeah. You don't want to screw around with the first sergeant.
No. Especially when an R&R is in the offing. And when it was as fondly remembered by you as it was.
Okay, so that would be the only other thing.
Yeah. Well, okay, now you had the presence of mind pretty early on to put off your R&Rs until toward the end. So you get back from Sydney, and you know that you're a short-timer. What's it like for you to be a short-timer?
Well, by then I was promoted to section chief. Keith, my partner, went home, we're 2 weeks apart. He went home. Now I'm running the firing battery. We're up at Charlie 2. We're being rocketed from time to time, staying down. And the one thing that happened that really stands out is that we had a time on target. We talked about those where X number of rounds going to hit the exact same second. We had our guns prepped, and someone gets on there from one of the other batteries that's shooting on this target. He said, "We shouldn't do this," he said. "We put an Arvin unit on that spot yesterday." So immediately, I called the guns. I said, "Check fire." Well, we had a lieutenant in there who's in charge of this thing. He said, "You can't do that." He said, we got the clearance." And I said to him, "We're not going to shoot on friendlies. Even if they're Arvins, we're not going to shoot on friendlies." So they called the captain, and I don't remember his name now, and I explained what was going on, and the lieutenant said, "We still have the clearance." I said, "We're not going to shoot on friendlies." Captain said, "Check fire, you know, punch the tube. We're not going to shoot this mission."
Hmm.
From then on, that lieutenant, his old job was to take the, we got a little movie every night, take the movie and the mail back to battalion and bring the new stuff up. That was his new job.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh.
So one thing I did accomplish, but there's no way I was going to go out killing friendlies. It just wasn't going to happen.
Absolutely. Now, do you think you've were emboldened in any way, knowing that your time was running short?
You have this mindset. We know we did kill some people. First, I need to back up a little bit. In Easter 1970, we shot a mission where we killed some of the 101st. Hmm. Now, thoroughly scrutinized, we did nothing wrong. These people are in the wrong place to give us wrong coordinates. Hmm. But that thing sticks in your mind. It didn't happen on my watch, but those people, it's like I'm sure they're still haunted by the fact that they'd called this mission in and we'd killed them. So you're thinking about this right away when this other thing came up. And even if a court martial broke me down and sent me to Long Bend Jail, I wasn't going to kill anybody that wasn't supposed to be killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's got to be, I would think, a positive thing for you personally, having to check fire on this particular mission and for the reasons that you did. Yeah, it sure.
Yeah, one thing I did right, that I know of, and they may not have been there. But you can't shoot that mission.
Yeah. And of course, you'd been there for quite a while at this point, and had knew the lay of the land and knew kind of the right and wrong of the fire missions and things like that. And obviously, moved to section chief, you have a little bit more authority than you would have had before as well.
Yeah. Again, the lieutenant was in charge, but then he had to answer to the captain.
Yeah.
And we had a really good captain again. Some of those guys might have gone and done it anyway.
Sure. Now, as your time is running short there, you mentioned that your friend Keith had already gone, rotated back to the States. What's it like for you, again, as a short-timer there? Does your routine change? Are you concerned about getting out of Vietnam safe and sound? Do you become more cautious? What do you do as a conscious short-timer?
Okay, I'm trying to think how to describe this. Because you're only going to do this once. You're trying to figure out what is it that you have to do to get on that plane. That's the whole overriding thing. So we're up at Charlie 2, which is on the DMZ. So I've got to get back to battalion. I've got to get battalion to clear out. I get my finances. I get all the stuff sorted out. I've got to get a ride down to wherever I'm going to catch my Freedom Bird. At the same time, at Charlie 2, we're getting rocketed. They set a booby trap right outside the gate that a deuce and a half hit, blew the whole front end off the deuce and a half. Hmm. Yeah, you got to get out of there alive. I'm not worried so much. The rockets are still coming in, but they kind of leave you alone during the day. But you got to worry about the booby traps. You got to get a ride back to battalion, so it's probably 60 miles one way to Phu Bai, and it's largely there's nobody out there to help you, really. It's just you and this jeep, and for the most part they leave them alone, but they don't always. So you want to have your weapon, you got to be ready. We're going to take this ride back, and then you got to think about how are you going to get to the next steps. So you get back to battalion, first thing you do is turn in all your gear. Well, somebody stole most of the stuff that we'd left back at Sally. Our gear was at Sally. So I'm turning things in. I don't turn much in but my weapon. And I'm thinking I'm going to have to pay for all this stuff. Well, turns out I didn't have to pay for it because we're up there at Charlie 2. They wrote all my equipment off. So all I had to do was turn in my weapon. So well, that was pretty easy. When I got to finance, there was nobody there. I had to sit in this big Quonset, and it's right there by the airport at Phu Bai. It's at noon. There's nobody in the building with me. I'm just sitting there. And there's this huge explosion. Couldn't even describe how loud it was. So I went outside, and there was a mushroom cloud. You always think about these nuclear weapons, but there was a mushroom cloud going up over the airport. And I thought, they've fired something in there, destroyed the planes or hit the ammo dump or some damn thing. Mm-hmm. Turns out it's a thing called a landing zone bomb. I don't know if you ever heard of these things. Mm-hmm. What it is they put a huge pile of explosive on a wooden platform, and they take a C-130, they fly it over an area where they're going to drop this thing. They put a chute on it, and it pulls the sled, if you would, of explosive out the back, and it comes down on a parachute. It's got a trigger on the bottom, so when it touches ground, this thing goes off, and it destroys everything within about a 100-meter circle called the landing zone bomb. I think it's 20,000 pounds of explosive. And they were just practicing with this, but I didn't know, and no one knew at the time, that this thing was going to go off. They stopped all the traffic within 20 miles of where they're going to drop this. This, I guess, a new toy, if you would. Mm-hmm. All right, so now finally, I'm coming down from that. I get clear finance. I get to the airport. There's a C-130 coming. There's probably 20 of us going to get on this plane. And the crew gets off and walks away. They're tired. They're going to go sleep. We can't go. We're not going anywhere.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. So I'm standing there with my luggage, and there was a colonel with us, and he was going there. He jumps the pilot. He wants that pilot to fly that plane out of there. He's ready to go right now. But the pilot told him, no, we're not going anywhere. So we had to wait. They had a four-hour nap. They came back out, get on the plane, and we fly, and end up going down to Cameron Bay. That's where I left from.
Mm-hmm. That's probably a long four-hour wait, I would think.
Oh, everything else that's happened was even longer because this colonel is really ticked, and no one wants to cross him. So he's pacing up and down. He wants to get on this plane. Oh, well, anyway, we get down to Cameron Bay and check in. I get a new uniform. I get I had these low quarter shoes. These low quarter shoes that have spit shine for all the way through basic and AIT. They're just beautiful shoes. I've tried to put them on, and the sole separates from the shoe. The mold had got to it.
Mm.
All the time I put in those shoes, I got nothing. But I get down to Cameron Bay, and I get a new pair of low quarters. I get my new uniform when I'm going to wear it to the States, and all I have to do is wait for the plane to come. And it was about a two-day wait.
What do you
every
do
night
this?
Cameron Bay is getting rocketed.
Mm-hmm.
It's more fun, and you can't stay in the barracks because all these people are smoking marijuana. It was thick in there, so I'm sleeping outside in my new uniforms, laying on the ground, just waiting for that plane to come. I finally get my orders. I had a suitcase. I had my the bag with all my stuff in it, and they put us out on the tarmac. We're going to get on this plane, and these two guys come by with the dog. Dog walks all the way down the line of guys waiting to get on the plane, and then they turn the dog loose, and the dog comes right back up, and about five guys in front of me, he grabs somebody by his pants cuff and pulls him out of line, and then the rest of us get on the plane. And I have no idea what that guy had, but he had something he wasn't supposed to have on that. And the dog found him.
Yeah.
And you're thinking to yourself, you can't be so stupid as to do this. You get that close, and then you don't get to get on the plane.
Yeah. And wind up in trouble.
Yeah.
To some degree.
Whatever he did, yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Now, I'm on the plane. There's another guy on the plane from my battery. The guy had only been in country 5 months, maybe. So I went up to him and asked him, and he said he tried to send home a box of heroin. Again, these things came for 80 cents. You get like a milk creamer full of pure heroin. And somehow he thought he could send it home and make a lot of money.
Hmm.
So I said, what did they do to you? He said, they gave me a general discharge. They weren't going to, they had so many of these cases, they just give them general discharges and send them home.
Yeah. Rather than deal with all the hassle of the paperwork and court-martial and all of those things, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of blew my mind. Then I learned later that these general discharges could be upgraded. It sounded like maybe he got his upgrade.
Hmm. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
All right, you're loaded up on the plane. The door closes. Pick up the story there.
Okay. Everybody's really tense because, you know, they're still rocketing Cameron Bay. Do it mostly at night, but doesn't mean they couldn't send one in at this point. once the plane cleared land, we were over the water, and everybody just went crazy. It just went crazy.
Describe it.
It was bedlam. Oh, just everybody's so excited. Even if you go down in the ocean, you're away from Vietnam. You got through it. You're going home. And going back, we came over from Hawaii to Midway to Vietnam. Going back, we went from Vietnam to Japan to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And in Japan, we stopped and I bought some camera equipment. I got another body for my FT, and I got a couple more lenses. You can buy the stuff pretty cheap there. Mm-hmm. And we get back into Fort Lewis. We land at SeaTac, go to Fort Lewis. I'm leaving. By extending, instead of coming back and going to another unit, I get to go home. We had less than 5 months to go, what they call ETS, estimated time of separation. I was ETSing. I was getting out of the Army. I just had to clear finance there. They give you your pay, whatever you were owed. There's room was divided in two parts. Half was set on one side, half set on the other side. So this captain gets up there and he says, and this is on a Sunday, I believe it was. He says, we don't have enough money to pay you guys. So he said, this half gets paid. Of course, I was in the wrong half. And this half doesn't get paid. So you don't get paid. You got to stay here. So these guys, the other half, get their money. They put them on a bus, and they're gone. Now, they put us in barracks, but they had no rations for us. We had no bedding. It's just like I started.
Yeah.
So now I'm really pissed. So I go find a captain. He just happened to be a Special Forces captain. I said, Captain, I said, they're not going to feed us. He said, what do you mean they're not going to feed you? I said, that mess hall says they're not going to feed us. You know, we're supposed to get a steak dinner. But they didn't have one for us. They're going to, tomorrow maybe we'll get something to eat. So he went over there and he jumped them, and they got some food for us. We never didn't get our steak, but they got, at least got, I think we got bacon and eggs or something. Mm-hmm. Get some food. So we next day, they've had the money, and we get paid. They give us transportation tickets. Now, to use this transportation ticket, you got to wear a uniform. Nobody wanted to wear that uniform.
Why?
But we got on the bus. Two guys get out there. They take the uniform off. They take the shoes off. They're down to their T-shirt and shorts. And they get some lighter fluid, and they make a big fire out of their uniforms, and they dance around the fire. This is outside the gate. The MPs inside the gate, they're laughing like hell. These two guys get done burning your uniform. They get on the bus and put on their civilian clothes. They don't care anymore. And we go off into Seattle.
Now, you mentioned that no one wanted to wear their uniform. Why was that?
Because there's so much, you're so hated by civilians, especially in areas where, especially in liberal places like Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco, you stand out and you're a target for all these people that don't want us in the war. I mean, they really hated us, and you don't want to be a target. We just want to go home, and
you
got to deal with this.
All right, so you load up on the bus. Where does it take you?
It takes me to SeaTac, and I have family in Seattle, and they come pick me up. I'm going to spend a week with them, stay with them. So I got a chance to put on my civilian clothes, and it's really great. They're really, really, really good people. They're the family's Jones, and the father is my mother's cousin, and he's an engineer at Boeing. And that week, now he's the head electrical engineer for the SST. You know what the SST was? A supersonic plane.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows what the Concorde was, but the Boeing made three of these SSTs. He's our head guy. And Congress meets, and the senator from Wisconsin, whose name I can't remember, he said, we're not going to subsidize this thing. So essentially, the SST is killed. His job is over.
Hmm.
He brings back this stack of blueprints for the SST. He's going to use them for scratch paper. And had I had my head screwed on properly, I would have grabbed that and you know, because this is all the specs for the SST. He's got them all, and they're just scrap now. And I could have had that. I can still kick myself. Anyway, he's really ticked off. Everybody in Seattle is not buying Wisconsin cheese. I can't think of that guy's name because he's the one that did them in. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I got to hang out there. My cousin and I, we went all over Seattle. We were taking pictures and visiting the Space Needle and for a week. And then I got on the train. I could have taken a plane, but I came by the train, and it's a beautiful ride from Washington to North Dakota. You got these vista domes. It's a car sits 30 feet above. You know, you're sitting up in this clear enclosure watching the things go by. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And I still have to wear my uniform. I'm really nervous about this. But all the people on that train were retired people. And they actually fed me and took care of me all the way back to North Dakota. Huh. So I had no problems.
Well, that's refreshing to hear.
We got a break there. So I get back to Dickinson, where my parents lived, and called them up, and they were not expecting me. I don't know why. I mean, well, of course, I've been in Seattle for a week. Mm-hmm. But about an hour later, Dad came down and picked me up, took me back home.
What was that reunion like?
My dad was never demonstrable. I already told you, never told me he loved me. We shook hands. There was no hugs. I get home. My stepmother was there. She had a meal for me. And then next day, they have a party, welcome home party for me with the neighbors. And at no time did anybody ask me about Vietnam. They didn't want to talk about Vietnam. It's like I went out in the wilderness for 14 months. Now I'm back, and life goes on.
How did you feel about that?
Really, I was really confused and didn't understand. You know, Dad talked about his experience in World War II. My uncle talked about his experience in World War II, but nobody wanted to talk about Vietnam. He would not talk about Vietnam.
Would you have talked about it if someone had asked?
Yeah, you're trying to, you know, decompressing. You want to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
And there was nobody to talk to. So he said, all right, now we got to put all the stuff away and just forget it ever happened, I guess, and we're going to get on with our life.
It must have been pretty difficult.
It was really hard.
Yeah.
It was really hard, and if you talk to any of these guys, like, we all went through something like that. I only met one guy that he was a Marine. He was at Tet. He came back to St. Louis, and family really welcomed him, and they talked all about Vietnam. He was the only one I've ever met where that actually happened.
Hmm. And I'm asking you to speculate here, but do you think it was because they thought maybe you didn't want to talk about it, or it was such a politically charged issue they didn't want to talk about it? What do you think the reasoning was for that?
I think we were like a dead skunk. Hmm. It just wanted nothing to do with it. The media portrayed it that... well, of course, Callie in that business with my lay, had stuff like that was coming out. Nothing good was said about people serving Vietnam. Not on the media, CBS, NBC, ABC, nobody. The newspapers, we were just like a dead skunk, just somebody to be avoided. And I really didn't understand. I mean, didn't understand this was the way it was. Until I started applying for jobs.
Tell me about that.
Okay. I went back to school. I got my master's in microbiology, but I wanted to teach school. So when I finished my master's, I sent out 50 applications for teaching jobs across North Dakota and Minnesota. And I got no response, none. It was like I wasn't out there. Hmm. And I really didn't understand that. So I found a job at a VA hospital in Kansas City. VA hospital in Kansas City. I was looking for a research assistant. And they were using a device that I used in graduate school. Now, I have a master's degree. I'm a veteran. I've used the device. So I went down for the interview in Kansas City. The guy says, you're the best qualified. He said, you've actually used the device. But, he said, there's something called equal employment opportunity that's come up. And he said, I have to hire a woman, so I can't hire you. So I go back. I went all the way back up to North Dakota. I went to work for a construction company. It's the only job I could find. I couldn't find another job. Now, the guy with the draft board, I mentioned already, Wally Norgaard, that told me he had to take me.
Right.
Wally was working with me to get me hired by somebody. And he's really frustrated. He said, I don't understand why we can't get you a job. So into January, I still didn't have anything except this construction company. I was managed to get by with that. When I was called by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and I put my application in. My dad insisted I do that, apply to the federal government. Mm-hmm. And they said, with your 10 points, Vietnam veteran, you're the highest qualified person on this list. Would you like to work for the FDA in Dallas? And here I'm up. I'm putting a roof on a building in North Dakota. It's 20 below zero. The air compressor froze up, so you can't use a nail gun. You got to do it individually. Mm. And I said, when do I start? When can I start? Can I start tomorrow? Can I come down there? And they said, well, you're going to start on the 1st of February. So I packed up everything I owned. I moved to Dallas.
And what happens when you get down there with the FDA?
Oh, I loved the job. It was, I couldn't have asked for a better job. I worked as a microbiologist for the Food and Drug Administration out of Dallas. I can't even tell you how much fun I had. I actually came up to Lubbock a couple times.
Hmm.
And, see, I was trying to remember, there's a cafeteria used to, is it FERS? Can't remember. They were headquartered there and do all these inspections. Campbell Soup had a huge plant in Paris, Texas. I went to that a couple times. I went down to seafood. I did all kinds of crab meat inspections. Best job I could have ever had. It's the most interesting. I can't even describe how pleased I was. Everything worked out. I guess that's what the Lord says. Everything works out for those that believe in the Lord, and He certainly helped me out there.
Hmm. And how long did you have this job?
I had it for 31 years.
Hmm.
The first 10 years I was a microbiologist. The last 20 years I was an educator called a consumer affairs specialist. And I worked there in Dallas and Minneapolis, and I finished up in St. Louis. And I couldn't have had a better job if I'd planned it out myself.
Yeah. Well, let me take you back to the Vietnam War here a little bit. You come back in March of 1971. The United States is still obviously deeply invested in Vietnam throughout the end of the war. What did you think about the way the United States ended its participation in the war?
Well, of course, you're paying real close attention. I'm back reading all the news, Time and Newsweek, and May I see that Charlie 2, where I'd left in March, a rocket had come in and killed about 30 guys at the mess hall. It hit the mess hall, collapsed the sandbags, and killed all these guys. Then I see 1972, the 72 offensive, where North V's come down and then we bomb the hell out of them and they go back up. And you're watching this thing as it, and you're thinking, these poor bastards that are left, somebody's going to be the last guy killed. And you have real empathy for what these guys are going through, because obviously this war is going to end and the North Vietnamese are going to come down and take over. And you really want to see everybody come home, and you really feel bad that they haven't gotten there. It's like everybody's holding their breath.
What about when Saigon falls, April 75?
Well, it was dreadful. You know, you see the media coverage, see all these people trying to get on the helicopters, see the helicopters and the ships being dumped over the side. I never met or talked to any of the Vietnamese. You think, what's going to happen to all these poor people now that the North Vietnamese are coming in? Are they going to? Because we watched what happened in Hue, you know, in 68. Mm-hmm. NVA comes into Hue and they butcher 3,000 civilians. They just picked them up, took them out, and killed them. You think, are they going to do that with everybody else? You know, how are they going to How are they going to treat these people? And you watch the boat people, you hear about all the camps. You know, you're still part of it. You're still part of it.
Yeah. Now, you spent your, I guess, 14 months over in Vietnam. Was there any effort, do you make any attempt to get in touch with the guys you served with, or is this still something you tried to put away?
Yeah, right away when I came home, I went to graduate school, and that December, I wrote everybody a letter that I knew where they lived. I knew that Jim Pound lived in Arkansas. I knew that Keith, my best friend, lived in Illinois City, Illinois. His name is Keith Feldman. So I sent them all out letters, and especially to Keith, because Keith and I said we'd get together that first Christmas, and I said, you know, you still want to get together, I'll come down at Christmas. Okay, this is maybe the 1st of December. About a week later, I get this response, and I open it up, and at first I think it's Keith's wedding that I'm reading. And all of a sudden I realize Keith is dead.
Oh, my.
Keith was killed in a farm accident in November. It was, you know, it's like he ripped my heart out. Seriously, I'd never felt like this before. Hmm. You know, we go through all this shit, and then here he is. He gets killed in a stupid farm accident. So after that, I hear from Deacon. I don't hear from anybody else. And then we sort of lost track. And then I kind of put it all away after Keith's death. So we find I find Frank Martin Mibbs. That's where I started. And then I realized I should go back to talk to the Feldman family. So I find out where they're at. I drive over there and spend a day with Keith's family. He had a huge family. And they had me in for dinner, and they just wanted me to talk about what was going on. They had all these pictures, Keith, and then they had a whole bunch of questions. The biggest thing was Keith's dad, who's now passed on, and his mother and his brother, they were all afraid that Keith came back because they wanted him to work the farm. He didn't really want to be there, but they sort of forced, you know, they kind of coerced him into being on the farm. That was their concern.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, all the time that we talked, all Keith talked about was going back and farming that farm.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's all. And it really made his brother, you know, it gave him some relief. That his death wasn't, you know, because they forced him to come there.
Mm-hmm. That must have made him feel terrific.
Yeah. Then I found, you know, that one of our battery commanders, Captain Sloan, and one of our fire direction officers, Malcolm Decker. I started finding these guys. Jim Pound, I found. So we're sort of getting together. We're going to have our second reunion down at Branson in October. And I'm going to go down and see this. And I found Sergeant Matson. I can't tell you how pleased I was. I'm going to send you the stuff about him.
Please do.
He is a terrific guy. He did stuff there. It's just unbelievable. He was the instigator for the shaving cream fight, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but it was a huge stress reliever. I can't even tell you how big a deal this was.
Yeah, you made mention of that a couple of times. It must have it obviously really made an impression.
Oh, it was, you've never seen 200 guys run around with shaving cream shooting each other. Now, we got all that shaving cream. We'd saved it all summer. I don't know why anybody saved it. Everybody had like 6 to 10 cans of shaving cream. So this really was a big deal. And it went on forever. And it was, but Sergeant Matson was responsible for that and a whole bunch of other things. And I'm not going to take your time here, but I've got it all written down, and I'll mail it to you.
Okay.
So he was the biggest one. I can't wait to see him. I'm really excited. He lives up in Idaho now. I tried for years to find him. I just couldn't find him.
Yeah.
So I finally got a chance to talk to him, and he was really a great guy.
That's terrific. Was it difficult for you knowing that when you came home and, you know, Keith came home before you and other people were coming home after you, that the group that you spent all this time there with was scattered to the wind, in a sense?
Yeah. You're trying to get back in the world, if you would.
Yeah.
It, what I tell people, and I talk to kids all the time, I said one of the things that happened over there was that there were no birds. Okay, this it doesn't sound like much of a thing, but there were no birds. You get up in the morning, there's no sound, there's nothing. And here you're surrounded by jungle. You know, should be birds everywhere. And there were none. I saw one red bird once, and I saw a small flock of what looked like sparrows one place. That's all the birds I saw or heard in the whole 14 months I was over there. Now I'm back in North Dakota. I get up in the morning. I hear the birds, and I still hear them. I mean, you get up in the morning, you probably don't even notice them. But every morning I hear those birds, and I think, we really did a number on that country with that defoliant. You know, we killed the jungle. And, you know, you see a lot of dead trees when you're over there. And the woodcutters are out cutting the dead trees and selling them. And then you have all this other undergrowth there that came back after the defoliation. But the animals, we got rats and roaches, but we don't have birds. They don't have birds.
It's amazing the things you remember, isn't it?
Oh. The bird thing, really, of course, the defoliants, you hear it, everybody talks about Agent Orange. One day in 1970, Armed Forces Radio came out and said, President Nixon has stopped the defoliation. That very same day, it was a helicopter spraying our hill. So I got on the radio, and I called the pilot, and I said, what are you guys doing? He says, we're spraying the hill. I said, what for? He says, defoliants. Well, number one, there was nothing growing on that hill. I mean, it was already dead. I said, well, don't you guys listen to Armed Forces Radio? I said, we're not spraying anymore. He says, well, I got more orders. So he finished spraying the hill. All that spray goes down the hill into the river that was just below us there, and that's where we're drawing our water from. All the water we're drinking is coming out of that river. And I was thinking about that. You know, what exactly are we doing here? That's when I started thinking about Agent Orange, which you don't know what it's called until you get home.
Yeah.
And what's happened here?
Do you think that you've suffered from any sort of conditions as a result of exposure to Agent Orange?
No, I didn't. I'm pretty sure. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't have anything wrong with me, but we've got a lot of guys that have Agent Orange-related issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of them. Half our 170 guys have diabetes. The only thing that ever happened to me is I lost my hearing to a certain extent, and I got tinnitus, and that's you'd expect in an artillery battery.
Right, right.
So I get 10% from the government. I'm happy with that.
Now, looking back on it, Mr. Aird, and again, a very general question here, but how do you think your experiences in Vietnam most affected your life?
Well, it made me a far more responsible person than I was before I went over there.
How so?
I was pretty, I think the term is callow, not concerned about anything. I'm just going out and have a beer, and I'm not looking much past my first paycheck. Mm-hmm. When I'm teaching school, looking forward to the summer so I can go fish. And after Vietnam, all of a sudden I'm focused on what I want to do with the rest of my life. I'm looking for a wife. You know, I want to have a family. I want to have a home. I want to settle down. That all is because of my experience in the military. So I had a very positive experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really trusting anymore. The Army taught me about that. One more little quick story. This is kind of the way the Army worked. When I was in basic training, everybody gets you get a file with all your information, you know, everything they've done. One of the things they did was take some dental x-rays. I'm looking at these dental x-rays, and I'm looking at my wisdom teeth. Look, I mean, they're really bizarre. They're going every which way. So I take that x-ray, and I go into the dentist at AIT, which is in Fort Sill. I say, would you take these wisdom teeth out? He looks at them, and he says, yeah, I could do that. He says, but you'd be better off if you wait till you got to Vietnam. So I get to Vietnam, I'm going through orientation, I take this x-ray over to the dentist there. I say, can you take these wisdom teeth out? He's looking at them. He says, yeah, he says, I could do that. But he said, you might get an infection over here. He said, get an infection over here, they can't really fix it. And that really was true. Once you got an infection, you're really screwed because it didn't seem like you'd ever get rid of it. Hmm. So he said, what you do is you wait till you get out of the Army, then you go over to the VA hospital, and they'll take those wisdom teeth out. So I get out of the Army. I go to the Fargo VA hospital. I'm going to school there. And I said, look at these wisdom teeth. No, wait, back up. I get a free dental exam. So I get my free dental exam, and the dentist is there, and I say, okay, I want to schedule my wisdom teeth. I want to get them taken out. He says, we're only responsible for your regular teeth. He says, you were not responsible for your wisdom teeth. He says, you're going to have this done on your own. So I became very less, I don't distrust people, but I don't really trust them either.
Yeah.
Because it seems like somebody's always trying to jerk my chain like this.
Yeah.
So I'm real cautious.
Sure.
So the Army did that for me, too.
Hmm. What other ways do you think that it affected you, or are there any other?
Yeah. I've always had a real strong work ethic, but one of the things that came out of the Army is you're helping everybody, okay? One time, the gun crew needed somebody to hump Joes, you know, carry these 200-pound shells. So I went out there and helped them. Otherwise, the mission wouldn't have got shot. We only did that once, and I got all kinds of flack for it. But I became more of a person who wants to help other people. And I'm still that way. That's my whole retirement's built around helping active duty military and also, you know, veterans. Somebody needs some help, I want to be there to help them.
Yeah.
So the Army really did that for me, too, because no one else is helping us. You know, I'm sure you know that the Vietnam Veterans of America was founded because no one would accept us. And so I want to go back, and I want to help everybody I can, especially these active duty people that are having multiple tours.
Yeah.
That all came out of my experience with the Army.
What about your religious beliefs? Did your experience there change those in any way?
Now, again, I was what you call a token Lutheran. And after the explosion and the ammo dump and all this other stuff, I realized just how close I came in a couple places. I decided I wanted to become a real Christian. My wife, the woman I married, was a Catholic. I was Lutheran. So we compromised. We looked for a church that was Bible-believing, and right now we're in Assembly of God. That's not necessarily where I'm going to finish, but I believe there is a God. I believe that He did protect me, and I tell people that. I don't run around with a loudspeaker or anything, but if anybody asks, yes, I believe there is a God. I believe He does protect me, and before Vietnam, I really wasn't there.
Yeah. You mentioned working with veterans, and obviously we look at veterans in a different light today than we did as a country, as a society back in the Vietnam era. How do you feel about the way Vietnam veterans have been portrayed in general in American culture and American society? And have you seen that change?
Yeah, the movies, you know, they portray us as a bunch of baby killing, dope smoking. But the truth is finally coming out that, yes, there was a melee, there was a lot of drugs being used, but the majority of us were there trying to do our best to make sure that country didn't fall to the communists. Mm-hmm. And all we did was our job. We didn't do anything. You know, some were heroes for sure, like Frank Metz, but most of us were just there to get a job done and then come home and then go on with our lives. And now, as an organization, we're finding people, you know, they're inviting us to come to schools, for instance. I'm going to go to a high school here in St. Louis on the 26th of April. Hmm. And they have a day just set aside. They have one for World War II, one for Korea, one for Vietnam, and then one for Afghanistan, Iraq. and the history teachers are trying to, you know, show the kids what we were really about instead of what the liberals wanted you to believe we were. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. We're becoming accepted now. And the most incredible thing is we got, there's 10 times more people that said they were there than were actually there. these wannabes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it bothers a lot of our veterans. It doesn't bother me. I don't know why anybody would want to think that they're a better person because they're in Vietnam. But all these guys are out there. I run into them from time to time. You know, they're very obvious when you talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of sad, I guess.
Well, I've got just one more question for you, Mr. Aird. And it will be a broad question again. But as you look back on it, as we look back on it as a country, we try to decide what the lessons of the Vietnam War were. And the legacy of the Vietnam War means this, it means this. We still don't have any sort of consensus and may never have any sort of consensus in a lot of ways. But as someone who was there, what do you think is the lasting significance of the Vietnam War?
Well, I think America turned a corner there. I think we just don't have the will to do this again. I look at Korea, and you know that was another war where people looked. You know, it was a war where these guys, the Forgotten War, they call themselves, but the outcome was different. In Korea, South Korea is a tremendous economy, a great friend. I mean, you look at Vietnam. It's one of the fourth most repressed nation in the world. We didn't do it for them what we did for Korea, and I think it's sad. I think if we could have somehow kept the North out of there long enough for them to build their own military, and their economy would have thrived. And it really hasn't. It's really the comparison between Korea and Vietnam. It's night and day. As far as I'm concerned, we did help the Koreans, and we didn't help the Vietnamese.
Mr. Aird, is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
No, I just thank you guys for what you've done. Lost and Found was a huge help. Again, it helped me find Frank Mebs. And if you send me an email again with your address, I'll send you this other stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I will here in just a few minutes. That's no problem at all. Well, okay then. I guess we will wrap it up, and I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.